Representative Scott is my colleague and fellow co-chair from the House. Really like to thank everyone for having us here. It's a great opportunity to get out of the Capitol, visit your very fine community. Matter of fact, Senator Carter insisted we visit your very fine community. So we're very pleased to be here. We'd be remiss if we didn't thank your good representative, Mr. Chip Shields, also. So really appreciate the opportunity. Before we get started, I do also want to thank Dr. Pulliam and Dr. Gatewood. I think they'd like to say a couple of things maybe to the group beforehand, before we get going, if they wouldn't mind coming up right now. Let's do that. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you. Well, first of all, good evening to everybody. We're very pleased to have the committee here. Everybody okay? Okay. Well, first of all, I'm President Pulliam, District President here at Portland Community College. Again, welcome to our Cascade campus. We are very, very pleased to have you here. We feel very honored. Let me also recognize three people who are here in the audience. I'm very fortunate tonight to have three of our board of directors here. Doreen Margolin. Doreen, would you just raise your hand, please? Harold Williams, Director Harold Williams is also here. And Director Jamie Lim is also here, representing our distinguished board of trustees. With me, beside me, is Dr. Gatewood, L.G. Gatewood, who is the campus president here at Cascade, and he will also say a few words of welcome. I just want to take a few minutes tonight to share with you the opportunities and the challenges here at PCC that we're facing. Just some background about our college. This college covers a large county area with ever-changing needs and challenges. Our district serves both rural and urban areas. At any given time, we're contracting with hundreds of businesses in terms of training. Our partnerships with local high schools are very, very strong, and we have a strong dual enrollment opportunity with a number of four-year colleges and universities in the state system, all including Portland State University, Oregon State University, and other four-year partners. We have been very creative and adept at looking at ways in which we can expand our offerings and serve the community even better. We strongly feel that community colleges are the best investment in the state in terms of our future economic health and vitality. The budget reductions we're experiencing in the last 4 years have really affected many of our residents. Since 2001, community college enrollments have dropped by some 75,000 students across the state. Just want to share with you some facts. This is our fourth year of significant budget reductions here at PCC. Currently, we're discussing community college support fund for 2001-2003 was $440 million. We're now talking somewhere between $416 and $420. We're simply asking to be brought back up to $440 to give us a fair chance in terms of providing access for students. Reductions in state funding are coming, unfortunately, at a time where increasing costs, operations are increasing. For example, PERS alone will increase over $5 million next year. Unfortunately, our college has had to make some adjustments, but the basic change is there's less affordability and less access. We have reduced the last year 32 programs and courses and programs and sections. We are reducing this year another 25. These reductions mean cuts in faculty, staff, but again, the most important thing about it is it provides less opportunity to access. Our tuition has risen by more than 50% between the year 2001 and 2005. Enrollment here has dropped by some 20,000 students. Our most expensive programs are those technical programs, and at the same time, we're often hearing from our business partners that there's need for more training in terms of their employee and technical areas. In closing, I just want to say community colleges are indeed powerful economic engines for the state. We are about responding quickly and supporting the needs of our residents and our service area. We certainly appreciate it, and you've got a really tough job, and we realize that, and we certainly respect that. But we also ask that you give us real consideration in terms of funding for you. Again, thank you very much, and we're very honored that you're here tonight. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Co-Chairs, Vice Chairs, and members of the committee. I'm Algie Gatewood, president of the Cascade Campus, and we certainly want to welcome all of you here tonight, and it's very important to us that you are visiting with us. It's indicative of the support that we must have from you. I want to give you a brief overview of the Cascade Campus and our vision. This campus was once the home site of the old Cascade Christian College, and after they went bankrupt in the late 1960s, Portland Community College acquired this property with the assistance of the Model Cities program and opened a small college center. Since then, enrollment has surged, and today we serve more than 14,000 students a year at this location. We offer a full complement of college transfer and associate degree programs, as well as a variety of technical programs such as criminal justice, medical assisting, ophthalmic, medical technology, fire science, multimedia, emergency medical training, medical laboratory technology, adult basic skills, and high school completion courses. We have strong partnerships in this community. We have partnerships with the Portland Public Schools and Jefferson High Schools in particular, and Jefferson is right next door to this campus. This is also the campus of the Portland Teachers Program, a partnership between Portland Community College, Portland State University, the University of Portland, and Portland Public Schools. And through this program, we grow our own for teaching today and in the future. We're also the home of the Portland Community College Skills Center, founded by our very own Senator Margaret Carter, and we're so delighted that you are here also, Senator Carter, and for the work that you did to help found the Skills Center. The Skills Center assists our chronically unemployed residents. It helps them to move from unemployment into training and into jobs so that they can become gainfully employed with living wages. So we're really proud of that program. The building we are in tonight is one of five buildings made possible by a bond measure that our voters overwhelmingly approved in 2000. We will open the final building from that measure in fall of 2005. The new buildings and the location of the campus in the heart of this neighborhood, one of the most diverse communities in the entire state of Oregon, have sparked a renewed pride and vitality in this part of town, and we are proud to be a valued member of the community and a resource to the people. We have big plans, we have dreams, we have visions for the future for this campus and for the ways in which we can continue to strengthen the links with our community and serve more people well. Many of the dreams can come about by careful planning and reprioritizing our budget, but others are dependent upon gaining adequate support from the state. We hope that you will also see the potential that our community colleges have for improving the economy in Oregon and prioritize your budget to support education at all levels. Again, I want to thank you for coming tonight. We're absolutely delighted to have you. As you can see, we have a large crowd, more than we anticipated coming, but this is indicative, I guess, of the kind of support we have in this community. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate that very warm welcome and certainly very good words. Set some ground rules, and what we're going to try and get through this in a couple of hours, 2.5 hours probably at most. We have some people from downstate, Southern Oregon, that need to get back to where they've come from. You've got some senators and representatives from around the state wanting to hear what you have to say. Since we have such a large crowd, I'm going to be very strict about the time you get to speak, just so everyone gets a chance. So please don't take it amiss if I try and hurry you along. Hopefully everyone will keep their comments to 2-3 minutes at most. I'm sorry about that. I'm very, very sorry. But otherwise, people just won't get a chance, and that would be a bit of a travesty. We'll go through these slides in a minute. I'll try and run through it, hold myself to 10 minutes, so I'm going to speak very, very fast. There are copies of these slides up front if you want them afterward, just to set the stage for what's going on. There's one more person I should acknowledge that's here that has really helped spearhead this whole public process, and that's our Senate President, Peter Courtney. Peter? Recognize Speaker Karen Minnis from our Portland Gresham area, who also is very interested in the public process and wants to make sure that we all hear from you. Real quickly here, What we're trying to do is set a stage. As you well know or may not know, we've had some budget problems, much like you all have at home, for the last 4 years. And it's made us, like the community college here and other places, have to make some very tough choices. The 1990s, the boom economy's gone away. And as a result of that, we believe at the state legislature and the Ways and Means Committee and the members you see here before you that we've got some structural deficit problems. We are not going to be able to fund all the programs we have funded to date. Some of these programs will go away. Some of these programs will suffer some severe reductions. Our job, like Dr. Gatewood and Dr. Pulliam talked about, is to make some very, very tough choices here. Taxpayers in the state of Oregon have indicated we have so much money to spend. Matter of fact, this legislative session, for the first time in recent history anyway, maybe in the history of the state, we have agreed as a body to spend a defined amount to build a sustainable budget for the coming biennium. It may mean some very tough love here. And so we're here to really hear some of your responses. What we're going to go through here is what we call the co-chair's budget. This is not biblical. This is not written in stone. This is an effort by my colleague, Representative Scott, my longstanding institutional memory person, my good vice chair, Margaret Carter, and Representative Susan Morgan from downstate, to kind of put what we think our committee members, who you see on either side of us, some of the hard work they've done for the past 8 or 9 weeks, and put this in some sort of template form to give you something to look at, to give them something to look at, to push back on. So with that, I'm going to run through these slides very, very quickly here. I've got a few minutes. The first slide will be coming up in a second. This is the most important person in Salem. This is Ken Rocco. He actually helps make sure, like all good, tremendous staff people, that occasionally represent Scott and I don't look too silly in public, and he's going to try and do that right now. These are what we actually, like many of you, when you go to in some of your local community groups, we have some principles, some budget principles that we're going to be guided by. Dr. Gatewood talked about particularly priorities and performance outcomes. So that's our top two. You can see there's a number of others. We have set certain budget levels. We're trying to be thoughtful and innovative in how we buy services, make sure that we don't miss any opportunities. We kind of cut through the mandate barrier. And in the final analysis, quite frankly, actually have a budget process that links into the interim, meaning the time we're not in session. We're only in session for about 6 months every 2 years, right, Wayne?
Right.
Hopefully only another 3 months. And we're out of there. The next slide will go to gives a basic outline of where the money goes. And I don't care if it's the governor spending the money, Representative Scott spending the money, Senator Schrader spending the money, or Senator Carter spending the money. These are the rough chunks of the pie. For every dollar you give us, 42 cents goes to K-12, maybe a little more, maybe a little less. About 11 cents or so goes to other programs. And even this is deceiving because it has a big chunk of money that's going to be distributed amongst all the other programs. It's our hardworking public employees. So you can see the human services, public safety, and K-12 occupy almost 96%, 95% of our budget. It's quite a chunk. So we're trying to prioritize what you think is most important. The next slide outlines maybe the basic numerical differences between the House co-chair plan and Senate co-chair plan. As you can see, we all add up to the same number, $12,393. That's $12,393,000,000. Sounds like a lot to me. I'm a veterinarian in real life. I'd love to have that sort of income. But when you're funding all these great programs, you have such needs and so many people in our great state, it doesn't go as far as any of us would like. Next slide. This is really Ways and Means stuff. You all go to sleep for a few microseconds here. This is the comparison, if you look across the top, about how we've been spending our money for the past few biennium. We go back to 0103 and we show last biennium, the biennium we're still in, and then we kind of compare where the governor's recommended budget was when we came in December. Now that we're $200 million better off based on a more recent forecast, we budget based on forecasts, nonpartisan independent forecasts. The House and the Senate are trying to reallocate what the governor originally did and spend that extra money just a little bit differently and trying to maximize what we think your priorities are. We can go on from there. Next slide. This is a basic slide on our education, the state school fund, which is what the what we give the K-12, our public education system, not community college, not higher ed. You can see there's the governor's original budget. Again, he did not have the advantage of the March forecast that we did. And he also, actually, we're assuming money we don't even have yet to get to that 12,393. And that's how Representative Scott, myself, and Senator Carter come up with our bottom line numbers. You can see there's local formula dollars involved in that. We show you some of the public employees' costs that we incurred that were again referenced by the community college. And you can see there's a little difference there between those two budgets. I think the next slide shows growth in the school funding over time. What's probably most notable is you look at the light blue, local revenues. This is all Measure 5 stuff. I think many of you are very familiar with. With Measure 5, the local funding went down. You can see there was a fairly dramatic increase in our state school funding. That was what you wanted, or we thought you wanted anyway, as a result of the outgrowth of Measure 5. But now that we've gotten out into the, 99-01 biennium and on, you can see that while the graph goes up and down a little bit, that the increase in the state school fund, at least from the state's level, hasn't changed a whole lot. We haven't had the money as a result of the recession that started in 01 to really make some of the investments that I think any and all of us would like to have had happen. Next slide. This is just to give you a feel for where the money's been spent. This is an 0507, again, compares the different program areas. You may not know what's going in, you know, to the fish and wildlife. You may not know exactly the amount that's going into community college. But you can see by program area where the state legislature and the governor has decided to put the bulk of their money. Again, the all other columns a little deceptive, and we can talk about that if you have questions later. Next column is the next slide, similar, shows it from a slightly different perspective. Given the different time frame, the change in growth. Next slide. Sorry about going fast, but I don't want to hear from you. You don't want to hear any more from me than is absolutely necessary. One of the reasons you'll see in our budget, we made some decisions regarding funding community colleges and higher education, trying to knock down those tuition increases. You can see over time the dramatic increases we've had in tuition. The state support has lagged to keep the quality of the institutions up. Unfortunately, the universities and community colleges have felt they've had to increase that tuition just to keep that quality there. And it's put them in a tough spot, and we're starting to see right now. The big thing you take away from this slide is when that dark bar goes up, which is tuition, the dotted bar goes down. That means kids are not going to school. They can't afford to go to school. That's a tough situation. The next slide is for the community colleges. The same story there. When their tuition during the 90s, we were pretty lucky. Modest increases students were willing to take, and parents were able to pay. But as we get into the total lack of state school fund support, and again, to maintain that quality, the kids decide to vote with their feet and they're not going to school, and we don't want that. Next slide is a basic outline of prison population. You can see that ballot measure 11 is driving a huge chunk of that. A lot of different people, a lot of different feelings on ballot measure 11. The bottom line is it is a mandate by the people, and we are building prisons. The public safety budget is increasing faster than any other budget in our state right now, hopefully to keep your community safe, but it is a cost, and a cost ordinarily we would be putting into perhaps some other areas. Next slide shows you the same sort of thing in a different manner. You can see that Department of Corrections, that's our prison budget, has gone up fairly significantly over the last few biennia. We're not alone. Other states are doing the same thing or being forced into the same situation. Next slide. This is a real quick slide. OWEB is our Watershed Enhancement Board. This is Measure 66, another measure that you all voted in, mandated that a chunk of the lottery money that we have goes into parks and also goes into projects to make our natural resource and our environment communities healthy. As you can see in 0305, we only were able to do a modest amount of grant funding as a result of the depths of the recession. We're now hopefully able to add some of that back, put some money into our environment as well as some of our main public safety, human service, and education areas. Next slide. This stuff is guaranteed to put you to sleep. This is the stuff that Senator Carter loves to go over time and time again. She just loves going over this. She's a budget person. And this is the stuff that Representative Scott, Representative Morgan, and Senator Carter and I have gone through ad nauseum, and we'll go through some more after we hear from you and we hear from the committees as they finish their work. I would emphasize to you all again that we're kind of in the middle of our work and zip through that, Ken. These are the different program areas. This is human services. more of human services, big chunks of our budget, public safety, lots of different areas in there, making puts and takes. These are the types of small puts and takes that can make a big difference in a program and its effectiveness. Natural resources, and then finally, all other being less than 4 or 5% of the budget. So that was certainly a very quick overview. I made it almost in 10 minutes, which isn't too bad. Appreciate that. Let's go back. Why don't we leave the budget principles up on the screen? Because that is really the guideline, at least I'd like to think it's the guideline, by which we've made most of our decisions. Oh, and there is one more slide at the very back that talks about visiting the website. If you want, I'll give you Ken Rocco's personal phone number for anything you really have a question about. Don't call Senator Carter, please, or me, or Representative. No, I'm just kidding. Please call us, not poor Ken. But this gives you a website. These slides will be on that. You don't have to worry about it. You can sit back, take your time, go through that, call us, come to the Capitol, and ask us why the heck we did some of the things we did. All right, well, let's get started with some of the public testimony here. We're open to testimony. Again, 2-3 minutes maximum, please. I'm going to be pretty tough on that. Senator Carter said she'd help me. And then if you have questions, you may ask a question also. And to the best of our ability, we will try and answer it. Don't be too hard on my colleagues on either sides of us. They're going through what the co-chairs and vice chairs did also. So if you have real problems with it, direct your angst in a constructive fashion, if you may, to the three of us probably rather than our colleagues. All right, with that, let's get going. Well, I'd like to have people come up, maybe several at a time, and we'll just zip along through this and take our notes. Oh, we got some more. Whoa, we're going to have over 100 people here.
I think you said 3 minutes. That's too much.
3 minutes.
In order to hear everybody, I think you need to go to 2 minutes.
2 minutes,
so
okay. You heard the senator. I listened to my senator. All right, well, I'd like to have Lee Berg, Austin Reed, and Terry Parker come. Well, there's only two chairs there. How about Lee Berg and Austin Reed come up if they can? Well, you're right there. The next people up will be Terry Parker and Lewis Buttons, please. Get ready to come on up. Go right here.
Good evening. My name is Austin Reed.
And I'm Lee Berg.
And first of all, we'd like to thank you for giving us the opportunity to speak tonight.
We're juniors at Madison High School, and in our class titled Natural Resources and Public Policy, we spent a week bouncing or simulating that we were the Oregon State Legislature.
Oh, great.
We broke into 25 different committees, and each of our committees came up with their own idea of balancing the state budget. And we did this through program cuts and tax hikes.
And here now a quick sample of what our budget committee came up with. The Oregon State budget has an urgent dilemma on its hands. Currently, the state needs to make $803 million worth of alterations. These alterations could come in the form of cuts to public schools, cuts to higher education, cuts to human services, cuts to public safety, and the raising of taxes. The Budget Management Committee has devised the following changes that would correct Oregon's crisis and supply the amount of money the state is in desperate need of. And we're going to give you guys about 15 seconds if you want to take a look over that real quick.
That's good. Okay, we're done. We're going home.
Okay, and these changes would correct the money shortage in Oregon. However, these new cuts in taxes will not come easy. Many people will lose out on money, and many will be hurt by these alterations. The Budget Management Committee did not cut anything from public safety, and the cuts to public schools were kept at a minimum. The children are our future. Their education should be the top priority. It was decided that many of the taxes should be raised. This will also hurt many people, but there were simply no other way. The state of Oregon is in need of $803 million, and this money must come from somewhere. The best way to acquire this money is through taxes. Oregon is in crisis. This is our one way out. Does anyone have any questions?
Yes. Thank you very much. Madison High School is in my district. You guys did great work. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Very good. You should come down and sit in some of the hearings. That would be really helpful for us and maybe interesting for you all. Thank you for coming. Right. Is Terry Parker and Lewis Butts available? Oh, we got another seat. Good, good. Thank you, Josh. Give that to Josh as soon as he's done. Please go right ahead.
Okay. I've got a copy of what I'm going to say. Can you hear it over the phone?
I can hear it great.
These are kind of sound bites related to the budget. First, state legislation must place controls on excessive administrative salaries and golden parachutes for civil servants at all levels of government in Oregon. This would include the salaries and perks of school superintendents and library directors. When I was in school in the Portland school system, the size of my classes averaged 35 students. Some classes had as many as 40 students. With all the new technology such as computers, the internet, getting an education is much easier than when I was in school. If the new standard or norm requires mini classes where the number of students is less than in the high 20s per class, then people like myself should receive a yearly state income tax credit. My future is right now. On the revenue side, there's a lot of rhetoric about putting education first. However, property tax abatement programs that allow new developments, including million-dollar condominiums, to escape paying property taxes for 10 years, not only place lining the pockets of developers ahead of education, but place these developments ahead of and at the expense of reduced public services. These programs must be ended, and the only way to do that is through the legislature. There also must be stricter requirements placed on urban renewal districts, reducing the amount of land mass a city can consider for urban renewal, and reducing the amount of districts can exist, the time districts can exist. School districts must also receive their share of property taxes on increased values in urban renewal districts. Again, this requires legislative action. This is a big one. The minimum corporate income tax must be increased from the current minuscule $10 per year to somewhere in the $1,000 per year. The trend where business continues to pay less and less of the percentage of the total tax revenue collected by state must be reversed. The split of what the state collects from business and individuals must be closer to a 50-50 partnership. Thank you. Legislation must make it easier to harvest dead and dying trees after catastrophic disasters such as forest fires. We do not continue to allow zealous overprotection of the environment to hold jobs and Oregon's economy hostage. Related to transportation, sharing the road must also mean sharing their financial responsibility. Bicycles are subsidized 100%. The legislature needs to establish a statewide bicycle license tax for riders 18 years of age and older. TriMet riders pay less than 10% of system costs. Since buses use the same roads as other vehicles, the legislature also needs to establish a transit rider tax, possibly a nickel a ride, to help support roads. Finally, the bottom line is fairness. Taxes and fees should only be assessed based on the services received, not a political agenda based on controlling what kind of housing people live in, what choices they make in transportation, or any other freedom of choice. Thank you for allowing me to testify today.
Nice job. Thank you. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I assume that was Mr. Parker. He didn't state his name.
I'm sorry. Yes, Terry Parker, and I handed you a sheet with the address.
Right.
Thank
Everyone
you.
Should identify themselves.
I apologize.
Well, that's my fault, not yours.
I'm C. Lewis Butts, Jr. I'm a student here. I have a lot of politics, but I'm not going to talk about that. The face I'm going to give you is a student who is an adult at 49 retraining themselves for a job. I was a musician for quite a while and still am. I have been looking for work in high-tech areas and electronics, and I'm taking here at Cascade in Sylvania engineering classes as well as fiber optics classes for being an installer. I noticed here that several of the classes I have taken for me, as an example, have shown me that I'm still able to learn stuff and still have confidence that even at my age I will find work. We have had several companies, including companies like Verizon and another company in Beaverton, actually come to us to look for students because they don't have a lot of people trained in the type of installation we do, which is fiber optics, and the type of technical testing in it. It happens at this college. We also have one of the few certified teachers who can actually teach people, certified to teach them for that. The new building over here in which that is occurring in, if we have a lot of the budget cuts that are going to be going on, we barely going to have these classes barely get off the ground for somebody like me. Literally, certification comes in three or four. If it's dead this time around coming up or the next time around, I'm done. And there's really no place else to go. So in a sense, this college has helped me look to have some hope for, in a sense, making myself more marketable as a laborer and on a personal level as an independent contractor in electronics or in places like audiovisual and communication technologies. You have to stay on the edge, but everything changes every day. And this college is coming really close to that. I'd hate to see a community college that like what happened in Boulder before the Colorado, before the community colleges started to straighten themselves out, become kind of a joke amongst adults and amongst students, like, well, you go there, but you don't really get anything done. It's what people say a junior college is, per se. Here, I haven't seen that happen, but I see a danger of that occurring. So,
thank you.
And thank you for coming.
Let's get Chip Sammons up, Sid Burt, and Michael Dembro. Then on deck we'll have John Nelson, Brad Perkins, and Peggy Ellis. So we need Sammons, Burt, and Dembro, please. You may go right ahead.
Good evening, everybody. My name's Chip Sammons. I'm the owner and janitor of the Holistic Pet Center in Clackamas. We're a health food store for pets. I started the business just as an idea because I wanted to have a store that only had good products for dogs and cats, and I started the store in 1988. Before I started the store, I went to Clackamas Community College and took some classes, and then I continued going there. If it were not for Clackamas Community College, I would not have a business, because the professors and the counselors have stood by me, for some of them, for 17 years. And they're always there to help. And there have been some tough decisions. I mean, I know you have tough decisions to make with this budget thing. But there have been some tough decisions to keep a small business running for 17 years. As a result of that, I've been able to funnel millions and millions of dollars into the local economy. I use my printers. I have vitamins that I have made in an FDA-certified lab that we ship worldwide. I mean, I am just a micro mini business, and I have been able to filter millions and millions of dollars into the local economy simply because of the tools that I got at Clackamas Community College. So from the economic point of view, that's that. And then yesterday, I hired my sixth employee. And she was so excited to get a job. I mean, she had the eager eyes of somebody who wanted a job. She's been wanting to work at the Holistic Pet Center for a long time. And when I saw her eyes, you know, and saw her excitement, it just made me feel good. It made me feel good that I have the opportunity to employ people. I mean, six people might not seem like much, but they're now depending on me for their job. And some of these employees also go to Clackamas Community College. My son went to Clackamas Community College, and it's just an ongoing education effort that spurs the economy, the local economy. And so from an economic point of view and an employment point of view, I really hope that although you have tough decisions to make, I hope you make them for the community colleges.
Thank you.
Thank you, representatives and senators. My name is Michael Dembro. I am the president of the PCC Faculty Federation, and I am also a member of the faculty of this campus, Cascade Campus, where I've taught for 25 years. And I want to thank you, first of all, for coming out and holding these public forums. It was so exciting for me to be out in the hall with all those people and feeling that energy of people who want to make a difference and who believe in the ability of government, of public service, to make a difference. And that's what this college is all about. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail, but I just want to say that in the years that I've been here, I have seen literally thousands of students who in other contexts would have been considered throwaway individuals, whose lives here were completely transformed by the experience that they had here. And that's because here at the community college, somebody comes to us, we take them as they are, and we help them to go where they need to go. We are a gateway to great things. And just today I ran into a former student, this happens every day, of course, who is, I hadn't seen for a few years. He's just finishing up his four-year degree. He's wanted some advice on going for a master's program. He's decided to go into teaching himself. This is a student that our society was virtually giving up on just 5 years ago. But because of this college, things changed for him. Now, it worked for him, but what's going to happen to the students who are following him? My written testimony includes a list of all the budget cuts that PCC is looking at now under the current budget. The community colleges need to have their budgets restored at least to where they were 4 years ago. We're looking at a budget that is much less than that, even under the ideal scenario. And so I would encourage you to look closely, and I would encourage you to show leadership, to show the citizens of this state that the dream is still alive. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good question. Okay, if we can get Mr. Burt's not here, we go to Mr. Nelson, Mr. Perkins, and Ms. Ellis, please. Thank you, gentlemen.
Ms. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. My name is John Nelson. I'm a lifelong Oregonian and a product of the state's K-12 community college and university system. My four children attended public schools, and I, for the last 6 years, have served on the Reynolds School District Board of Directors. As you may know, Reynolds is a medium-sized district in East Multnomah County. The district is experiencing growth in student population and an increasingly diverse student community demographic. Providing an adequate, let alone a quality education to student populations speaking 45 languages is increasingly expensive and is taxing our district infrastructure to the breaking point. Recently, the ITAX has kept Reynolds and Mother Multnomah County schools above afloat. Sadly, other districts around Oregon lacking these supplemental funds have had to make draconian cuts. I was disheartened to hear the government shout out the 5.0 billion number, and I'm equally concerned by the numbers coming out of both houses of the legislature for public education. Multnomah County schools will need the state funding level of about $6 billion to maintain our current levels. While I do appreciate the Senate's efforts to squeeze additional funds into the schools, it's hard for me to be enthusiastic about the 5.325. Yes, the kids need the resources. Yes, we appreciate the effort. Yes, we know that the legislature cannot just create adequate funds for schools out of thin air. We get it. But does the legislature get it? Okay, we support the short-run plan for the 5.325 with reservation, but after that, what? I urge you all to put aside the all-too-familiar game of finger-pointing partisanship and patchwork funding, and urge you all to take the remaining time that the Multnomah County voters have given you to go back, get out of the box, find the leadership, the creativity, and the political courage needed to once and for all establish solid funding for our schools in the state of Oregon. I love Oregon. I know you do, too. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good testimony.
Brad Perkins. I live here in Portland, and I'm a member of Stand for Children, own a company called Perkins Realty. I want to emphasize what this gentleman had just stated, and it is the main point why I'm here tonight as well, that there needs to be a structural change in this state on our taxes. Senator Schrader, you mentioned it just earlier tonight. We have structural deficit problems. Well, we elected you all to help fix it. That's the bottom line. We shouldn't be coming here every 2 years and going through this routine. Our energy, all the people that are here tonight, out in the halls, unfortunately, it should be a better facility that we're in, a little bigger for everybody to be here. But our time is precious, too, and so is yours. We should be able to spend it on other things other than coming every 2 years to debate whether it's 5.17 $5.4 billion, $5.325 billion, $5.4 billion. Let's be good examples for our children, and let's restructure the system. Okay, one other way in which we can look at this tonight, forget about the overall picture. Let's look at what we have to deal with tonight in regards to what we have to spend. One of the ways in which we can eliminate some of the tax breaks is to not give the tax break for second homes in the state of Oregon. Increase the tax enforcement. Maybe raise the beer and cigarette tax. One of the things that businesses are already agreeing to, many of them in the state of Oregon, is raising the corporate minimum tax. My own profession, I'm part of a small group that is working to actually have a real estate transfer fee for next biennium to propose to you. We are gaining momentum to do our part for housing. If we stabilize funding for schools, we wouldn't be spending more time talking ways to improve schools. One of the things that's also being done right now, and thank God the governor has put money aside to hire Jim Francesconi to dovetail businesses with schools so that these high schools can have kids that come out that are better trained and able and directly functional to work in the into the business world. I think that's a great possibility for improvement in the whole state of Oregon. And there's a small group of people that are also working in that. The Portland Business Alliance is working to go along that line as well. So I just want to leave you with one last thought, and that is that Measure 37, where are we today with that? Okay, where are we? If the state leaders had done more to tweak the land use laws, we wouldn't be in the problem that we are today in trying to fix this Measure 37. One of the things that is never discussed is the fact that we have now having to pay people that have had a problem with the land use measures the way they are, and we have to pay them. Well, how about all the people out there that have gained through the change of zones in on their land? One thing that never spoken to. So let's think of the total structure next biennium and fixing it. If we talk sales tax, let's talk sales tax. Maybe that's one of the ways to do it. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Peggy Ellis. I'm an Oregonian. I'm a constituent of Abel Gordley and Jackie Dingfelder. I've been an educator in public schools for 31 years, and my husband is a retired teacher from Portland School District. I live in Northeast Portland, but I teach across the river in Vancouver, and let me tell you right now, that's really a good thing. We're funded so much better. It's becoming quite stark, the differences. I'm a reading specialist, and we are able to teach according to research in small groups and have very well-trained teachers and make awesome differences in the lives of kids who struggle, who would ordinarily struggle in school. We're able to get 65 to 70% of our students to grade level, and these are kids who start at the bottom of their classes. But it takes money to do that, and I'm really sad as a citizen of Oregon to see that my colleagues who taught in Portland, many of whom have lost their jobs or who are stretched so thin, are feeling like they're not able to be as effective as I am across the river. And I'm a member of STAND, and I believe in investing in our future, and I'm very sad that we appear to be a state that's not doing that. In the last 2 weeks, I've talked to two people who have plans to send their kids to private school. And these are wonderful people whose children should be able to get free education. But they're so worried about large class size that they feel they need to invest in private school. What can we do about this situation there? I think there are things we could do. I think you guys need to be gutsy. We elected you to do things that will represent us and our children. And it's not okay to keep passing the buck. We need you to get in there and restructure for us. Education is much better funded across the river, and I'm here to tell you, I've been doing it over there for 31 years. My own kids went to school here, and I thought they had a good education, but they're grown-ups now, and we're not funding education to the level that our daughters were able to experience. So please do something about this. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, let's get, I noticed the Multnomah County Chair has come in. We had Diane Lynn, you want to come up and say a few remarks for us? And we'll also get Elaine Lieberman and John Sutter to come forward, please. And have Margie Brown and Sue Sutton and Margie Rosenthal on deck.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Multnomah County. I'll be very brief tonight because you're really here to hear from the citizens of this community and from all around the state. And thank you for taking the effort to be out and about like this and offer this forum tonight. My simple message tonight is something you already know, which is we're very proud of this community for stepping up and passing a tax to themselves and this community, the people that live here, the people that know that kids need a good education, and they're all paying that tax this very week as we sit here in front of you today. And for a lot of families, that's a terrible and important burden that they're taking on, and for some families, it's a serious trade-off of other kinds of things. That tax is temporary, and we will sunset it the end of next fiscal year. We are looking to all of you to improve funding for education at the state level, which is where the responsibility lies, for better or for worse, to come in for the next biennium and pick up where you left off several years ago in supporting public school funding. Again, Multnomah County is very proud of its support to public schools. We've had great results. We're actually taking a bite out of the academic achievement gap. We're supporting schools in after-school programs and in other ways that are very, very important in partnership with the schools as our premier prevention program to quit spending money at the late stage, worst stage of the process, which is something else you're all grappling with, which is just how much we're going to need to spend to build prisons in this state. Let's put the money into education, get kids educated, get them into jobs, and not build more prisons when there's opportunities for partnerships between us on things like public safety. Thank you all very, very much for being here, and I appreciate the opportunity to listen to more testimony. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, thanks for coming to Portland so we can
testify.
Let's
be ready. We can get one more in here.
Eliane Lieberman. I'm a member of Stanford Children, a parent of a fourth grader at a Portland public school, and a co-founder of a Portland public charter elementary school. At the end of March, Portland Public Schools released their proposed budget for 2005-2006. It was based on an estimated $5.3 billion state school fund, and even at that level, the district will be eliminating 251 full-time equivalent positions this year and an additional 74 positions next year. Each school has been making the hard choices of which positions to eliminate. My daughter's K-12 school staff has made maintaining class sizes, which have already increased during the past 10 years, a priority. Reduction in education-related programming will occur with reduced hours for technical support, the school counselor, the librarian, the registrar, and other classroom personnel support. Next year, there will be no other choices left but to increase class sizes. Additional budget cuts that will affect student learning and achievement and their ability to succeed are cutting staff and limiting costs in English as a second language and special education, reducing outdoor school from 5 to 3 days, and eliminating some sports programs. This comes on top of a decade of reduced state funding that has caused the reduction or elimination of music, art, science, and physical education programs, counselors and librarians, and a steady increase in the size of classes. Oregon spends $611 less per student in today's dollars than in 1992, and that is over $29 million that Portland Public Schools no longer has to spend on its students. Staff is concerned for the students. Many students will no longer receive the services that enable them to succeed. As one teacher said, it is one thing to be asked to go from a house with two bathrooms to a house with one bathroom. Now it seems like we're being asked to move out altogether. There are reasonable options to generate revenues that don't cut services or raise taxes for the average Oregonian. And if my household income was inadequate to enable my child to succeed in school and was not enough to pay for my grandmother's life-saving medication, I would do whatever else I had to ensure that my child succeeded and my grandmother lived. I expect no less from the leadership of the legislature. I would not say, oh, well, because I have to live within my budget, Grandma and my child will just have to make do. I would be working as hard as I could to find other means to get my family what they need. You have those other means at your disposal, ways to raise revenues that do not increase the tax burden on ordinary citizens. Oregon's students and the future health of our economy and state deserve a K-12 education budget set at low no less than $5.4 billion. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chairperson Schrader and Scott, members of the committee, my name is John Sutter. I'm a member of Stand for Children. Thank you for coming here to Portland tonight and for hearing our testimony. We appreciate it. My wife, Jenny, and I have two children enrolled in the Portland Public Schools. You've heard from Eliane about some of the cuts that are happening in one of those schools, Metropolitan Learning Center. I'll try and be brief and cut it to my remarks to what's happening in another one, what the proposed cuts are that we're seeing in the front lines in our public services at the Irvington Public School here in Portland. Based on the 5.3 budget, the Portland Public Schools has put together a budget for next year, and the principal at Irvington has been forced to make some hard choices with that. As of now, unfortunately, I believe that the choices she's being forced to make, you know, while trying to preserve class sizes at 25 or 30, she's being forced to cut kindergarten classes, and I think that that's going to fundamentally alter the character of our school and be a big loss for the Portland district as a whole. You see, right now, more than half of Irvington's students come from transfers into the school from outside the neighborhood. As a result, Irvington is blessed with students coming from a wide range of backgrounds from a variety of different neighborhoods in the district. By cutting kindergarten classes from 3 to 2, we're going to be limiting those abilities for those children to transfer in. And not only is the principal being forced to do that, but she's also being forced to say that only those students who can transfer in are those that can pay for the full-day kindergarten, which is not the case now. And that's eventually going to really alter the character of the school, change the richness and the diversity that my children have experienced. And it's really a sad loss for the community and for the Portland Public School District. And that's just as an example of what's happening with the 5.3 budget. So I really, you know, wanted to give you that example, wanted to add to the examples of what the cuts are out there. I want to encourage you to pass a 5.4 budget for K-12 schools. As I say that, I do also want to say that I don't think this should be at the expense of other public services. They've been also suffering, and maybe there's a few areas on the expense side that could lead to savings, maybe Measure 11 reforms or other things, but they're more fair options on the revenue side, whether it be curbing excessive tax breaks, repealing the corporate kicker, cracking down on tax cheats, or making corporations pay the same rates that I do are some of the ideas that maybe you should consider to make this budget a fair and keep up the public services, the education, the public safety services that we have in the state. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Margie Brown, and thank you, Senator Schrader and Representative Scott, for coming, and all of you to being with us tonight. I'm the mother of two daughters who were educated in the Portland public school system, and I now have a granddaughter who is a third grader. And my daughters received an education that allowed them to compete at the university and graduate levels. And I'm hoping that my grandchildren will have that same opportunity. But my granddaughter's parents, continue to be concerned about the staff cuts to their school and the larger class sizes. And they're weary as parents of the constant fundraising that they try to do just to hang on to some of the basics, such as a librarian. In the past, Oregon has been proud of its schools
And I understand that Portland has been one of the outstanding urban districts in the country. But unfortunately, Oregon's continued disinvestment in its schools puts all that at risk. We have asked our educators to be accountable, and they have shown steady gains in student achievement despite the unstable and reduced funding. And superintendents and district and school boards have cut administrative costs to keep the class sizes down, but still class sizes in our state are 30% larger than the rest of the nation. At a time when our nation is concerned about the obesity of our children, we're cutting their physical education programs. And when studies are showing that arts and music facilitate the learning of basic skills, we're eliminating well-established programs that may take years to reestablish. This not only deprives our children now, but it puts the risk of future arts and culture for our communities. How can we expect to compete in the global economy when schools are forced to cut foreign languages? In asking for the $5.4 billion for schools, we are not asking for sufficient funding to even begin to reinstate what is being lost. $5.4 billion will only keep things from getting worse.
Thank you.
Quality public education is what enables every citizen the opportunity to reach their aspirations. And creating a well-educated citizenry is basic to the development of a strong, representative democracy. Investing in public education is crucial to the economic health and livability of our state. And I believe the legislature has the responsibility to fund schools and social services and should not continue to give tax breaks and entitlements that do not benefit the health and welfare of the entire community. We cannot afford to shortchange our children, because in so doing, we are shortchanging our future. Thank you.
We want to move rapidly along to make sure everyone gets a chance under this an hour. Good testimony, very good testimony. But try not to read if you can. Just paraphrase, and we'll keep your copies if you've got it written for us. Thank you. Please go right ahead.
Hi, I'm Margie Rosenthal. I'm from Lake Oswego, but my children were educated in the Portland Public Schools, and they had the benefit of small classes. They had the benefit of excellent sports programs and the benefit of choir and art possibilities. They went to excellent colleges, and they are now working here in Oregon, and they had the opportunity of a school system that I don't see currently before me. I have been an employee of the Portland Public Schools. Then when I retired, I was a volunteer in the classroom, and I am now a reading tutor for children in inner-city Portland schools who have reading problems. And I want to talk to you for a minute about what the budget cuts, how they affect class sizes, and how that affects children's ability to learn to read. And I've written to many of you, but I'm restating some of what I said in my letters to you. Most of the children that I work with are not severely handicapped children. They are not reading, but that is not because they are not intelligent, nor is it because they don't have the ability. It is because they come from a classroom where they have not had an opportunity to get individualized instruction, and they may have a learning style that's slightly different than what the rest of the children in the classroom have. I work with children who, with very small amounts of individualized or small group instruction, do learn to read. And if they are in a classroom with 30 children, that is not a conducive atmosphere to learn skills if you have any kind of a learning problem at all. I can give you an example of two children that I'm currently working with who are fourth graders. One of them is a special...
Let's go with one example, if you don't mind. I'm sorry.
Well, I want to explain them. One is a special ed child with lots of problems, needs extra instruction. The other is just a child who is shy and needs the extra help. She needs an after-school tutoring program or an in-school individualized program, and she will be a successful student. She is already at grade level now. When I started working with her, she was below first grade level. These children who don't learn to read, okay, in the first and second grades, they're learning to read. From then on, they're reading to learn. And if they don't get it by the end of second grade, we're setting them up for failure. And those are, as Representative Schrader said earlier, some of the people in, many of the people in our prison population. So the two relate to each other. Being unable to read is a critical issue. And I urge you to go ahead with your... going back and looking again for ways, creative ways, as the other people have said. I won't talk about that, but I want to say one more thing. Yesterday was a very embarrassing day for Oregon. Al Roker was in Portland donating to the schoolhouse supplies, and on national television before all those thousands and millions of people, he said, Oregon is ground zero when it comes to school funding. This is what he said on national television. He said, Oregon has one of the poorest school funding situations in the country. And it, I just couldn't believe hearing that on television. So take that back with you as you make your adjustments and look at least at a $5.4 billion funding, please.
Thank you. Got Holly Vaughn Edmonds, Harold Williams, Cynthia Chase, ready to go.
Good evening. My name is Sue Sutton, and I thank you very much for being here and listening to our concerns.
Sure.
I am a member of Stand for Children. I'm a CFO of a small nonprofit social service agency and have been in that category of business ever since I've been here in Portland working in nonprofits. So I get hit by all sorts of funding issues. But after the passage of Measure 5, I watched the school programs getting dropped from my own children's curriculum. And then the snowballing effect of Measure 5 plus the depressed economy in Oregon has just made that a continually worse problem. My grandchildren now starting into the public school system, and I find that even more programs are being cut. If the state fails to pass the $5.4 billion for schools, we're going to need to just keep cutting things. And for example, for sports. And this ends up putting us in an unfair situation because those parents, those families that can afford to fund the extra fees and the extra costs that it takes for their child to participate in sports, their children will get to play. The other children will not. And those children need that social and that physical activity just as much as the wealthier students. Class sizes are going to keep increasing, and the school years are shortened, and we all know music and art and other programs, again, are all being cut. You might think that this is an acceptable funding model for our schools, but it's not. Those families that can afford to will move their children into school districts that have a revenue base from the parents that live there that are able to raise funding to subsidize the programs that get cut. The other schools around the area that don't have that parental income base and cannot raise the funding will end up without the additional programs. This begins to make a large diversity between the poor and the rich. And this is not fair. And when you go further, the more children that move out of the school district, the funding in that particular school goes lower and lower. So it just gets worse. $5.4 billion for public schools, as we have said before tonight, only keeps the spending where it is currently. That's what we're asking. That's where we want you, as our legislature, to make an effort to raise the revenue to meet those needs. And we've talked about some of those areas, cutting some of the tax cuts or stopping some of the tax breaks to businesses, raising the corporate income tax. But as a legislature, most of you ran on schools. Most of you said schools was a priority. We want you to now look at what you promised us, step up to the plate, and find a way to raise that revenue and meet the needs of the schools. Thank you again.
My name is Bill Nickdom. I'm the kid who says the emperor has no clothes. I'm not going to make a case for education or any particular program. What I am going to say is that the budget process has over and over again pitted education against public health, against affordable housing, against public safety. The Honorable, and I do not use that word lightly, Avil Gordley, notified her email list recipients of two sections of the Oregon Constitution that if you would stop acting unconstitutionally, would solve the budget problems. They are Article 9, Section 2, and Article 9, Section 6. And before I read them to you, I just want to point out the meaning of the word shall. This is from the Merriam-Webster Dictionary. Used to express a command or exhortation, used in laws, regulations, or directives to express what is mandatory. Legislative assembly shall provide for raising revenue sufficiently to defray the expenses of the state for each fiscal year and also sufficient sum to pay interest on state debt. That's Section 2. Section 6. Whenever the expenses of any fiscal year shall exceed the income, the legislative assembly shall provide for levying a tax for the ensuing fiscal year sufficient with other sources of income to pay the deficiency as well as estimated expense of the ensuing fiscal year. Senators, representatives, you folks are naked. Get with this part of the Constitution.
Hi. My name is Cynthia Chase. I am a resident of Northeast Portland, mom, a member of PTA and Stand for Children, and I live in Senator Carter's district. Thanks for coming back. I'm here. You've heard the sad stories, and I just want to say that what I would like to see you do is address more income for the state, not look at cuts, not look at making health services compete with the elderly, compete with schools. I'd like you to look at raising the corporate minimum tax. I think it's very sad that PGE is paying $10, and I, as a small businesswoman, pay way more than that. I just wrote all the checks this week. I'd like to see you look at the cigarette tax, restoring the 10 cents. While I know this isn't exactly your parameter, we need to continue to talk to the Lottery Tax Commission and make sure that we're getting money there. And we need to be looking at mortgage interest deductions, and I'd like us to see us reevaluate property tax levels. I know that's not going to happen this session, but in 1990 when Measure 5 passed, there were some inequities that are continuing through. I know I own a house 2 miles from here, I'm paying $600 a year property tax. I don't feel that's fair. I'd like to see us reevaluate that as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Welcome.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Holly Von Edmonds. I'm a member of Stand for Children, as well as a middle school counselor at Beaumont Middle School in Portland Public School District. I'm here this evening to first thank you for your collaboration and your ongoing efforts to support funding for children in Oregon schools. I'm also here to speak to the fallout that has happened with our current cuts and past cuts, and also to request $5.4 billion in K-12 education. This is the amount that the State Department of Education has requested. On Monday evening, am I speaking into the microphone right?
Great.
All right. On Monday evening, our principals presented our FTE allocation for next year. She stated that out of the last 15 years she's been an administrator, she has cut programs and positions for 13 of the 15 years. She also stated that our middle school program is no longer a middle school program, where students get to take electives, so they're getting prepared for their career choices for high school and their futures. In the past, our children had opportunities to take foreign language, art, drama, media arts, yearbook, and computer programming, as well as band. The allocation for next year cuts all of the elective programs, with the exception of our band program. Art went last year. This year, the rest of all the electives are going. At the same time, our class sizes are going from 27 to 32, 6th, 7th, and 8th grade. When we're asking the core teachers to do more in terms of teaching more during the day, because they'll have to teach the electives, they're not certified to teach, we're also cutting administrative staff in terms of discipline to provide the support and the administrative support for those teachers in the classroom. Our vibrant two staff members who are new to our school are leaving. They're getting out of our district because they know they're going to be bumped, they're cut, or they're returning to California, one of them is. At the district level, we're cutting a program called Project Return. This is particularly of interest to me because one of our parents at my school works for Project Return. This is a program that provides bus tickets and services to those kids who are either homeless, in shelters, or they are not. They're doubling up with other families. One of my students said to me last week, I don't understand why we're cutting programs that are helping homeless children get an education. And I didn't have an answer. Most likely, I know you've heard these stories. You've heard them all night. And I know you're aware of, as the lady two times ahead of me said, that there are stable families that are tired of this weary battle, 13-year battle, against trying to get more funding. And they're weary, so they're leaving. But I'm particularly concerned, too, about the segregation of the haves and have-nots. In sum, oh, one more thing. My brother came and interviewed in Oregon this summer for an anesthesiology position. He was told by everyone in Oregon, don't come to Oregon. He was told in Salem, Bend, and Portland, your adequate and stable funding is not here for schools. In sum, our children, teachers, parents, and community deserve adequate and stable school funding. Please support the $5.4 billion allocation that our Department of Education has requested.
Get Rosemary Teeter, Chip Sammons, and Philip Chadsey on deck, too. Please go ahead.
My name is Harold Williams. I'm a board member of Portland Community College and also a member of Stanford Children. The difficulties of life we can handle with ease. The impossible takes a little bit longer. I recognize that you are dealing with the impossible, but however, education is primary. You look at things that you consider a priority. Anything that's a priority, you make it first and you find resources to address it. And since 1981 until the current time, the education budget overall has increased 21%. The correction budget has increased 280%. You tell me what is the priority in the state of Oregon. You look at the situation and you ask, what are we talking about? We're talking about a world that we unify and we make the city of Portland the city of roses, the state of Oregon, God's country. And we say, what is this all about? Bringing a better environment for all humankind so we can have education, so we can have opportunity, so people can have dreams. And we have the greatest institution in the state, which is Portland Community College, the largest urban campus, right here the way you are visiting us tonight, and we are glad that you're here. And we are the rainbow coalition of hope of every race, creed that is involved. If you take the opportunities for education, for every person to interface with one another, to have education so they can see America in a better way, see the state in a better way, then we lose the dreams. I work in an area where we deal with children who are disadvantaged, who are coming out of the correction system. Their parents have been in the correction system, and there is no hope for them. If we are not willing to deal with those who have resource and opportunity, then what are we going to do for those who are disenfranchised? Portland Community College gives hope to those who are willing and able to fight the cause for dreams. And all they ask that they give for dreams. Stand for Children is the voice for those who have no voice. They stand for the hopes of all of us, all of our children. And you deal with the race disparity. Most of you don't want to see the pain that goes on there. In this area, we have 60% unemployment. Where do people have hope if they don't come to this institution? Where do they don't have hope if they don't come to education? You tell me it costs $55,000 a year to imprison a person, and yet you can go to the best colleges in the world for $55,000. Tell me where your priorities are. The question is... The question is very simple. We have the best people in the world, but we cannot keep the best if we are not willing to pay them. You cut and you cut and you cut to the bone. The issue, ladies and gentlemen, senators and representatives, you have to deal with tax reform. I'm a small business person. I don't want to deal with taxes, but the reality is we're going to have to deal with a sales tax if we're going to deal with the issue that's going to address education. Those monies need to go to education. You have the responsibility, and you can make the decision. Not put it back on the voters, but you who we have elected can make that decision, and you have the charge to do that, to increase and make it fair, those who come into our state, use our parks, use our facilities, to pay taxes. If you do that, we will have funds for education. We'll do not have to cut other areas. And I'll end with this. To give without remembering and to receive without forgetting, that is the question. Are you willing to give, and do you remember from when you had a better day, and when we'll leave the opportunity for our children to have an equal chance that you had in the past? I hope you will look at it and make the decision that education is a priority. Thank you very much.
Excellent testimony.
Senator Schrader, Representative Scott, Representative Carter, and members of the committee, my name is Rosemary Teeter. I live in Frank Shields' Senate District, Jeff Markley's Representative District, Southeast Portland. In 1994, coming off a car accident that left me seriously injured, I didn't know whether I could learn or not, but I went to Clackamas Community College because there were no living wage jobs for me without a degree. Today, I have the honor and privilege of teaching students at Clackamas Community College. Students who are at risk of falling through the cracks, becoming part of that prison population that seems to be growing. Some of them have drug use problems. Some of them have had skirmishes with the law. Their ability to write varies from grade school level to college level. And what we're trying to do with these kids is the same kind of thing that a lot of other people talked to you yesterday about in Salem, turning lives around, making them productive members of the community. Ben Franklin said an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. In 1991, I worked hard against Measure 5 as the chair of the City of Portland Citizens Budget Advisory Committee. And I felt like I'd been kicked in the gut when it passed because I knew from what we had looked at that this was where we were headed. The people who were in prisons today were in junior high school and high school when Measure 5 passed. And we see the result of that measure in the increase in prison populations and the cuts that are being made to schools. To reverse the trend in the increase of prison population, we have to start now, short term. We need to fully fund education today so that the kids who are at risk today do not have to end up in the criminal justice system. Long term, we need to restructure the tax system to equalize the tax burden. Make Oregon a business-friendly state by showing employers how paying their tax burden benefits them in trained workers, in high-quality services, in high-quality schools. Business will not want to come to Oregon when the schools have declined to the point that we're looking at now. Show them how they'll receive bigger dividends for paying their fair share. Taxes are my dues that I pay to be a member of a community, a city, a state, and a nation. I'm willing to pay my dues. I have voted yes on most tax measures for as far back as I can remember because most of them are well thought out. And I really have a problem with the idea that a corporation can come in, take money out of the state, and put nothing back. Not okay. Bottom line, if not now, when? If not you, then whom?
Senator Schrader, Representative Scott, members of the committee. I'm Phil Chadsey. I'm here as a representative of the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill. NAMI has 22 affiliates in the state, covers the entire state. I'm chairman of the Legislative and Public Policy Committee for NAMI. NAMI is made up of people who have mentally ill family members, the mentally ill and professional mental health professionals. In 1999, the Surgeon General came out with a report that showed that major depression is a major cause of disability in the United States. Schizophrenia and bipolar disorder are in the top 10 disorders of disabilities. 6 out of every 100 people have one of those disorders. The way that we have treated our mentally ill people in the last 20 years is abominable. We have closed one of our major mental hospitals. We have a state hospital, as Senator Courtney will tell you, is 120 years old, is rat infested, and we are closing four of the geriatric wards because of the cuts in the budget. We need to restore the money that has not gone to mental illness in the last 4 years. We have been penny wise and pound foolish in not funding mental illness. 16% of the people in our state prison and our state or our county jails are mentally ill. Most of them there are because in the jails are there because of minor infractions. The jail population has basically become our default state hospital. It's much more costly to put them in the county jails and the state prison rather than funding adequately community mental health facilities. I would hope and urge all of you to seriously restore the money that's required for mental health services. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'd ask Tony Wong, Winter Stumpf, and Lyle Stumpf to come up and have Martha Hickey, Melanie Dixon, and David Rogers on deck. Try and keep your remarks, real succinct. You're doing a great job. Believe me, you're doing a great job. It's just there's so many. We want to make sure.
Can you tell us when to interrupt because we don't know when we're speaking. You have a clock.
Yeah, well, I'm trying to be very considerate, but I'm going to have to be tougher, unfortunately. Please go right ahead.
Hi, my name is Tony Wong, and I'm here on behalf of the CDRC, that's the Child Development and Resource Center for OHSU, who funds and helps with Dornbecker's Children's Hospital here in town. And we have Colby here, who has the PK view, was tested at birth, and 1 in 12,000 babies is tested positive for that. And the clinic here may possibly be on the verge of closing. We're hoping and praying not. There are very few of the clinics that can help children with this metabolic disorder. They cannot process protein properly, and it can lead to autism, seizures, tremors, all kinds of things like that that are not good. We would like to hopefully keep this open, this clinic in Oregon. Otherwise, they may have to uproot and move along with 1,100 other families and babies.
Very important.
And if they do move, who knows if they'll have the insurance where they move to.
Sure.
It's, yeah.
Thank you.
And these are lives.
My name is Lyle Stump. I'm the father of Colby. He goes to the CDRC clinic. He has metabolic disease called phenylketonuria. It's PKU. He, like she said, cannot process an amino acid called phenylalanine. OHSU has the only clinic in Oregon, and if this clinic takes severe cutbacks, me and my wife will have to move to another state. And I do not want to move. I have a great job. And I'm asking you, all of you as senators, and mostly as parents, please keep this clinic open.
Okay, I'm the mother of this little boy. His name is Colby. He was born in December, and he was born perfect. Everything was fine. We got a phone call at a week old because of the heel poke test done on every single baby. This is how he was diagnosed. Just about every 8 months, another baby with his disorder will be born. If he has treatment, he can grow to be completely normal, brain functioning, everything. Without treatment, he'll be so neurologically messed up, disorder, unable to speak, unable to probably eat, to live, to do anything on his own ever. He will be constantly supervised by home, by hospitals. With the help of this clinic, he can grow and just do everything that we want our child to do. He has survived through one surgery, and he is on a medical food that he'll eat his entire life. And without the medical food provided at this clinic, we definitely would have to locate. We'd have to leave. There's 6,000 families in this clinic. There's 1,000 with metabolic disorders and 140 that suffer from the same disease as my son. We would all have to up and relocate. And our children couldn't go without insurance for even 3 days. Their health is completely at risk. There's so many mothers that couldn't even bring their children here tonight because their children are in such need of medical assistance that they can't leave all their things that they have at home to keep their children alive. So this clinic is just so very important to us, for the health of our kids, and we really want the chance to see our baby grow to be normal.
Thank you.
Levels change.
Thank you very much. Get Ms. Hickey, Ms. Dixon, Mr. Rogers, and then have Mr. Springer, Dee Dee Peck, and Julie Massa on deck, please.
Hi, thank you for the opportunity to address you. I'm Martha Hickey. I'm a tenured associate professor of foreign languages at Portland State University. I'm also the chief negotiator for the American Association of University Professors, and we just started collective bargaining with the university. Every 2 years, you and your colleagues have heard university presidents and administrators and the chancellors come to you and tell us about our salary woes, I'm sure with some raised eyebrows. And every 2 years, for probably over a decade or more, we faculty have heard, well, from the governor, from the legislature, we'd like to do something for you, but we really can't really help you out this time. And so we come back to you again and again. And I'm sure you wonder, I wonder why it doesn't ever seem to get better, especially after that $7.5 million that the legislature so generously gave the Oregon University System in 97. Well, I have a theory about that, but before I tell you about my theory, I'd like to assure you that the salary problem is a real problem. In February, in preparation for bargaining, we took a survey of our 1,000 faculty members, researchers, librarians, academic professionals, and over a third of those faculty responded. That's a pretty good response rate, I think. And overwhelmingly, 78% of those people said that the biggest stress in their life is the state salary freeze. Now, I partly interpret that as a response to the general stagnation of faculty salaries at the university level in this state, but it's a real concern. And to put that in perspective, there are a lot of misconceptions, I think, about university salaries. Of the 1,000 people that I speak for today, half of those people make less than $50,000, some substantially less. To put that in context, $50,000 is the average salary of an Oregon school teacher. back to my theory. And pardon me, professors are supposed to have theories, so I hope you'll bear with me. I know that the governor has recommended that you legislators fund the merit and performance pay raises that the state employees who continue to do good work for the state probably deserve after that two-year freeze. I assume that's probably why the state personnel services budget has gone up 15% since the last biennium. But I also want to tell you that none of that money is going to those 1,000 people that I speak for today, for the simple reason that there is no merit or performance pay system in place for the Oregon University System employees, for professionals in that system.
You'll have to wrap up, I'm sorry.
Yes. I'd be missing the point of this hearing, I think, if I didn't ask for something. Tim Nesbitt, who's on the Oregon Board of Higher Education, told me that the merit system costs the state about 1%, and that's what I'd like to ask you for PSU. 1% of our general fund budget would be about $500,000, and I think for the state's largest university, that's the least we can ask for, given the millions of dollars that may be spent for merit raises for the rest of eligible state employees. It's in everyone's interest, I think, to build a sustainable rewards for faculty who do good work and into that budget at PSU and help us sustain that level of enthusiasm and energy that helped build PSU into one of the largest universities in this state, and that those professionals who bring the enthusiasm to their jobs and what they do for Oregon and for the children of this state, our children and our future. Thank you very much. And please fund the governor's recommended budget level for the Oregon University System. Thank you.
We might as well do a little better. Thank you. Yes, ma'am.
Good evening, committee members. My name is Melanie Dixon. I'm Director of Legislative Affairs for PCC Cascade. You're sitting in my second home. I am also a board member for Oregon Community College Students Association. And the reason that I'm here this evening is to stress the importance of fully funding the 440, or at least giving the 440 for community college, because it's just putting us back at service level. We've already been served the tough love, to kind of reiterate what you said earlier. And we would now like to be embraced and nurtured, if you can find a creative way to make that possible. We are really an important gateway for Northeast community and just all of the areas. I mean, we're represented out in Southwest. We're also represented in Rock Creek. We're a really important gateway into the workforce. And as you know, our economic situation is already grim. And I think not funding community colleges is only going to increase that. I think supporting community colleges is benefiting everybody. I am a parent of a child in K through 12, and educating me is also educating her. So thank you.
Awesome.
Chair Schrader, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity. My name is David Rogers, and I actually live several blocks away. I'm also the associate director of an organization called the Western Prison Project. We work for safe and sensible solutions to criminal justice problems. And in difficult fiscal times, I actually think that I might be sharing some good news. I'm going to suggest how we might be able to save millions of dollars. And I'm sure there are places where you can spend them. We have to get control of the skyrocketing cost of incarceration. The governor's proposed budget is for the Department of Corrections is $1.25 billion. That is a 34% increase, and that also includes a proposed new prison construction in Madras. That would cost taxpayers, the prison construction would cost taxpayers over $200 million that we and our children would be paying off for the next 25 years. That is on top of $100 million that we're paying this biennium for past prison construction. I would say that our credit card on prison construction is maxed out. Oregon cannot afford a new prison. Oregon doesn't need a new prison. Bricks and mortar is the most expensive and the least effective way of achieving public safety and crime reduction. Some people might think that the prison is an unfortunate but necessary expense because of Measure 11. I'm here to tell, and I realize also that many legislators from both parties are beginning to come to terms with the need for some reform of Measure 11, but I also know that that's going to come slowly. But I'm here to tell you that we've done the math, and we've figured out that the prison, in fact, does not need to be built based on some very modest reforms that do not touch Measure 11 at all. Three things need to happen. If we passed a modest increase in existing earned time for non-Measure 11 sentences, which is Senate Bill 435, which had a very positive hearing earlier this week in the Senate Judiciary Committee, it would save the state over $30 million in the next 4 years and needed prison beds. Use of the Wapato Jail for prison beds. An expansion of the existing alternative to incarceration program. Those three things happen, which seem very viable, we would not need $200 million of new expense for ineffective bricks and mortar prison construction. We have a very clear choice ahead of us. We can continue down a road which Max Williams, the head of the Department of Corrections, has acknowledged that the current growth in the prison system is unsustainable. So if Max Williams acknowledges that, we clearly need to do something differently. And not building matters would be a step in the right direction. Based on what I'm hearing tonight, I would suggest that your priorities should be education and not incarceration. Thank you very much.
Let's get Sam Adams. I think the city councilors here come on up, and then the other ladies. Just point out the actual new prisons. This by any means, it's about $25 million. The reason it's $200 million is because we backfilled with some federal money we had last time, so that now has to support the prisons, not just from this biennium, but from 2 years ago. Ladies, would you like to go first? Mr. Adams, would you mind if they went first?
Not at all.
Please, okay. Go right ahead.
Thank you, senators and representatives, for coming here tonight. My name is Diet Peck, and I'm a divorced 34-year-old mother of two preteen daughters. I'm a college student, a community representative for Head Start, and an volunteer advocate for the Oregon Food Bank. As you can tell, because my hand is in many different pots, that there's a lot of programs that will be affected with these budget cuts. I can't just pick out one and say it's the most important, because they all indirectly are related. Head Start. It's where children start getting an education. My third grader is reading at a sixth grade level because of this program. She's also doing fifth grade math. Do not tell me this is just a daycare. I also am putting myself through college, and my 12-year-old, she is in the seventh grade and doing high school level papers because she sees me every day studying. Tell me, this is not a good role model. So, being that I am a single mom, I also have to take advantage of certain programs, such as food stamps, such as daycare through DHS. If you cut these programs, what am I going to do? I can tell you, I'll have to quit school and get another dead-end, low-paying job to try to support my girls. Tell me, what do I tell them when they have to spend majority of their lifetime at a daycare, at getting up at the crack of dawn and not getting into their own beds until way after bedtime? I also advocate for other families who cannot speak for themselves, spending many days at the DHS office because they're eligible for programs and they're told they can't have these programs. They're not eligible. Those are lies, and I've helped file hearings after hearings to get these people through these programs. I'm really frustrated because I'm not as educated as many of you are. But I'm trying, and I'm trying to take and pass this down to my children and to families who cannot voice their opinions because they just don't know the resources are out there. I beg you, please, do not take apart these little vulnerable programs that help the vulnerable families. Go somewhere else where the money is there and I'm just so frustrated. I'm sorry. I'm losing track of my mind. But please, I beg you, to think about us, the vulnerable families. Thank you.
Co-chairs, vice chairs, and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Julie Massa, and I'm a public policy advocate with Oregon Food Bank, and I've lobbied many of you. And I'm going to save some of the statistics, but in our hunger survey recently, we found, and all of these surveys were distributed to nearly all emergency food box recipients in 100 different agencies, that 51% of the recipient households spent more than 50% of their income on rent. 43% of the recipient households had at least one household member working. 20% had full-time jobs. 15% had part-time jobs. The common thread in all of these families is that they're working very hard. And some of them are on welfare, such as Diette. Her family touched the food bank, and we were able to really cultivate an amazing advocate. But what I'm concerned about, what the food bank is concerned about, are these support services around the TANF program. And these are people coming out of TANF and are able to work, but there may be one paycheck away of really being able to be solid in that job. And these support services are slated to be cut to the tune of $2.3 million in the governor's budget. And I tell you that over the past 2 years that I've worked at the food bank, I received so many phone calls of people who are just trying to get to that next step. I heard earlier a gateway to greatness, and I love that term. And I think a lot of people don't understand that these entitlement programs are not just for adults. They're for children as well. And so when we support these programs and we support the supportive services, we are really taking care of kids that are extremely vulnerable as well. And I just wanted to give you, I gave you a landscape. Here's a portrait. This gentleman called me recently, and he had his, well, actually his wife was dying of cancer, and he had just been temporarily laid off and was going to be responsible for two children. This is in Bend. And he called me saying, I don't have money for rent. I'm very scared. Can you direct me to an emergency food box site? And I did so. And then after talking with him, I realized that he would be eligible for a program in TANF, and I directed him to the local DHS office. And within an hour, he had $700 to pay his rent, and he called me a week later and said, they called me back, I'm back to work. And that was that support program. So I ask you to hold those programs harmless. I understand you have tough choices to make, but they're so important in supporting families. And so with that, I just want to thank you for the opportunity to testify. And I could speak about all the other programs, but I've heard amazing testimony, and I just wanted to speak to that either, too. Thank you. Thank you.
Councilman. Good evening, Co-Chair Schrader and Scott, and members of the committee. First, I want to – my name is Sam Adams, and I'm here tonight on behalf of the Portland City Council. Asking you to give serious attention and consideration to the issue of school funding. And I want to start by thanking you for holding this meeting in my neighborhood, North Portland. It's really great to see such a strong turnout. The mayor, my colleagues, and I consider the health and viability of the 6 school districts in the city of Portland as vital to the future health of the city itself. And it is our hope that the legislature will find a way to respond by approving an amount of at least $5.4 billion for K through 12 education in the state's 2005-2007 budget. Portland families have endured over the past, oh, it's going on 13 years now, watching their neighborhood schools become more and more impoverished, and we have stepped up. We have stepped up with our Band-Aid efforts for our schools. We've contributed our own money. We have voted voluntarily for local tax increases. We have volunteered. We have marched. We have lobbied. And now we're asking that the hope, it is our hope, that the state will step forward with the necessary resources to stop the decline and to begin to rebuild first-class K through 12 education system. Just 5 years ago, the Oregon school spending per student was ranked 30th highest among the states, just slightly below the national average. And by 2002, 2003, Oregon school spending dropped to 31st highest among the states at nearly $1,000 per student, below the national average. Portland area families are exhausted and discouraged, and many of them are leaving the city. And in our most recent survey, schools was the main reason. Concerns about schools and school funding was a key reason for that. We are losing families in Portland at an alarming rate, despite our efforts to provide decent jobs and affordable housing for them, because they are no longer willing to trust their children's education to the chaotic funding system. Families are the building block of any city, and they're certainly the building block here in Portland. And these losses are deeply disturbing to us, as they should be for everyone. Family wages contribute millions of dollars in income taxes. Their children are the workforce of the future, and their presence fosters safe neighborhoods and thriving businesses. Please help us keep our families by assuring at least a $5.4 billion K-12 budget. Most troubling of all is that our children, for whom we have the ultimate and inescapable responsibility to provide the best possible launching pad into life, are simply not getting it. I could share with you, as I'm sure you've already heard, mind-numbing statistics about increased class sizes in the Portland area, the percentage of administrative cuts that we have already taken, the losses of teachers, aides, librarians, and school supplies, but the statistics do not reveal the real story locally. Too many of our children look to their schools as their second home, a place to be fed, a place to be safe, a place where they can connect with caring adults, a place where they can play, and, of course, a place where they can learn. This is a fact of life of thousands of children all over the state, and it's a fact of life here in Portland. For all school children, we ask for your support and your determination to pass a $5.4 billion budget. Co-chairs, members of the committee, I know you face difficult and wrenching choices and that you must juggle the competing demands of this budget that it presents you. Your work is appreciated, but I would ask on behalf of the City Council, however, that you be mindful of the lifelong investment you are making when a child walks into a school to receive an education. Make that investment the best it can be. Thank you for your courtesy.
Thank you.
Let's get Rick up. Rick, you came up here. Susan Bailey and Ken Pertner. I know it's getting late. We'll try and go a bit longer than we had scheduled, but you can email your comments, too, into the website, state.budget2005@state.or.us. So if you got to leave, state.budget2005@state.or.us. Appreciate everyone's patience. Rick, go ahead.
Good evening to all of you. My name is Rick Ukina. I'm a Northeast Portland resident. I come from the districts of Senator Gordley and Representative Dingfelter. My gift to you tonight is I will be extremely brief. Way down in the depths of the budget is a little area that works with Oregon State Extension. Why would a person who works for Oregon Food Bank, as I do, come to talk to you about Oregon Extension Services? Well, let me just say that the governor has made eliminating hunger one of his most important priorities since his first day in office. For many years now, OSU Extension has been a partner with Oregon Food Bank in this effort. As a person who has been trained up by OSU Extension and is a volunteer food education educator myself, there are programs here working with the food bank, working with the least of these in our communities. There are programs that work. So all I want you to do is when you're thinking about items, remember the importance of OSU Extension and the programs touching the little people in our community, helping them to achieve some of the greatness that they deserve. This has been an amazing evening of listening to the passion and the commitment of democracy in our community. And I want to thank you all for your amazing attention spans that you've had for all of us this evening.
Thank you. Go right ahead.
Hi, my name is Sarah Bailey, and I did have a prepared speech, but after sitting and listening to all these people making impassioned speeches, I decided to change it up a little. I sit before you as a success story of the public education system. I went to a small town called Rainier. We had a high school that it hasn't been funded very well lately. Both my mom and my dad are public teachers. It's just so hard on them to watch. There's funding be cut again and again to have art and band and vocational institutions cut. And so I urge you to fund the schools at the necessary level. I also urge you to fund higher education at the level that's necessary. I wouldn't be here if I had not received scholarships from PSU. I wouldn't have made it to college. Right now, I'm currently a junior at Portland State University. I'm majoring in computer engineering. I've been able to keep up a 3.7 GPA and get internships at places like Intel and Mentor Graphics. I wouldn't have those opportunities if I hadn't had the proper education that I had through public schools. And so I urge you to fund schools, to fund higher education at the level that they need to be funded. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Schrader, Representative Scott, Senator Carter, and members of the committee, thank you very much for being here. I will dare to quote Aristotle to you, who said that participation in the political life of the community is the noblest of human endeavors, and I thank you very much for being here tonight. I am here to speak on behalf of a different constituency. Although I speak for myself as a resident of Northeast Portland, I'm informed by my employment at Washington County Disability, Aging, and Veterans Services. And I'm here to speak to you tonight about part of your constituency who can't be here. Some of them because they can't get out of their houses. Some of them because they can't get out of their beds. These are our low-income seniors and persons with disabilities. The governor's budget proposed some pretty severe cuts. 2 years ago, we cut senior services down to service priority level 13. That means no one above healthier than level 13 gets assistance. Level 13 is people who need assistance eating, toileting, or getting dressed and out of the bed in the morning. That's the level of services that we have cut back to for low-income seniors who are very much in need of our assistance. I won't harp at you. I'm sure that Jacqueline Zimmer and lots of other folks have been to see you and you're aware of the programs. But I would remind you that Oregon Project Independence is a very important program that helps keep people from getting to that spot. The governor has proposed a cap on services, and putting a cap on services means that we will have in Washington County approximately 700 people coming to our door every year at level 13 to whom we will say we'll be happy to fund you as soon as someone dies or leaves the state. We have another program called Relative Adult Foster Care. Again, the governor's budget proposed to cut $21 million for Relative Adult Foster Care. Relative Adult Foster Care is a program where family members may take on the responsibilities of caring for someone who is eligible for services in their home because they give up their regular employment. An example is a man who is 57 years old who has severe multiple sclerosis. He's wheelchair-bound, unable to move the wheelchair by himself, and his sister takes him into her home and receives the generous amount of money of $950 a month from DHS to care for him. If we cut the relative adult foster home program, this lady will have to go back to work, and because he is eligible services, we will have to put him into a regular commercial adult foster home at three times the cost. So please be mindful that there are some trades that we have to make in all of this. But to go back, I think you are all being very worthy of Aristotle's praise. And I want to ask you, please, as you make these incredibly difficult decisions, please be fair to all of your constituents. Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right, let's see what we get. Jim Kilpatrick up here, Jeff Stanton, and Carissa Sims. We have Kirsten Hayes, Carol Cushman, and Doug Flashing on deck. Please go right ahead.
senators and committee. My name is Jim Kilpatrick, and I'm here, first time I've ever testified in front of a committee like this, and I'll try to be brief. But listening to the other testimony earlier, what I came to talk about in a way seems trivial, but in a way, I may have part of the solution for this. And a part of the solution is we continue to grow Oregon small businesses and make them a vital part of the economy. I'm here to share you how that's happened for me personally. I'm a general contractor, and I'm a living example of how facilities improvements and the capital budgets that you have approved in the past have affected people's lives and particularly my business. We started our business exactly 2 years ago. A large construction company that I worked for in the slumping Oregon economy rolled up the carpet and moved out of town. Myself and a few of the other folks that work there started our business with about five people. Today, we employ over 30 people and pay excellent wages and full benefits. We wouldn't be able to do that without the opportunities we've been given for working at places like Portland State University, Oregon State University, the Oregon University System. Those opportunities to do those kind of capital improvement projects have allowed me to grow this business and to become, I'm very proud of what we've done and proud of the Portland economy. I believe, you know, I think the commitment of our employees is a big part of it, but again, it's the opportunities that we've been presented by having those projects there to participate in. And it doesn't stop with general contractors in my company. We touch dozens of subcontractors and suppliers on every single project we do, and I know many of them are in the exact kind of state of businesses that I'm in, proud to be earning family wages for our employees. I can tell you that the projects we do are not pork kind of projects. I see many, many projects in these systems, the kind of projects as a taxpayer that money goes to, I'm proud of. I don't feel it's wasteful. And I know that the people I work with in all those departments at the different universities work hard and are good stewards of our money and work to stretch the dollars that they do have available to them. So, again, I think there is a line item there, and it seems I feel almost trivial asking that line item be looked at, but there is a leverage there and an impact beyond what it just may be as a capital expense, and it's easy to cut something back. So that's what I'm here in support of.
Very good. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Chip Legere. I'm a partner in a firm called Inline Commercial Construction. We've been in business about 22 years. Like Jim's firm, we depend on small commercial-type projects through the university system. It's really where most of our work comes from. And if the cuts in, like, deferred maintenance do take place, it'll affect my 45-some-odd employees plus all the subcontractors that we hire up and down the line. That program is very essential to our business. I mean, it's the majority of our work. So without taking a lot more of your time, I appreciate it if you'd look at that line item. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Very good. Okay, we've got Stanton, Sims, Hayes, Cushman, Fleshing, and Olson coming up. Go right ahead.
Chair Schrader and Scott, members of the committee, for the record, I am Carol Cushman from the League of Women Voters of Portland. I live on North Colonial Avenue here in Portland. The League of Women Voters is a grassroots, nonpartisan political organization which encourages the informed, active participation of citizens in government in order to build better communities statewide. The League strongly believes that it is the obligation of the legislature to sufficiently fund state services. Those services include those that provide for the protection, safety, and education of all. Although the League has positions on many state issues, we're not here today to promote any specific bills. Rather, we're here to ask that you follow through on your legislative responsibilities. If you, as legislators, think that services and programs are important, then they should be funded to the fullest extent necessary to reach your goals. We ask that you not pit senior citizens against schools or parks against police. It is your responsibility to provide for the well-being of all people in this state, of all ages, of all economic levels, and of all regions. We strongly urge you to look at all funding sources, including tax credits and increasing corporate taxes. We believe that there are ways to raise revenue without borrowing more or increasing the income tax. We ask for the establishment of a reserve fund and the provision of stable funding for education and social services. We know that by working together for the good of all, this legislative body has the capability and the will to craft a budget that will provide fairly for the needs of all Oregonians. Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to testify this evening on this issue and being able to do it without traveling to Salem.
Thank you.
Co-chairs Schrader and Scott and the Ways and Means Committee. My name is Douglas Fashing, and I serve on the Advocacy Committee of Portland State University. The PSU advocates are affiliated with the PSU Alumni Association and represent alumni and friends of the university. I've attended both public and private universities. I've received my bachelor's degree in history from PSU and my law degree from Willamette University. Today I work as an analyst at Standard Insurance. I was born and raised in Portland. I'm a product of the Portland school system, graduating from Grant High School. And I believe Portland State University offered me a foundation for my continuing education beyond PSU, as well as my civic involvement now. I'm here tonight to thank you for your support for higher education, specifically PSU. I am also here to urge you, despite limited resources, to make investment in higher education a priority. I want to comment briefly on the several areas that the PSU advocates feel are priorities for higher education funding. First, PSU has experienced tremendous increases in enrollment, and we expect to increase in the fall. In 1995, PSU served just over 14,000 students. This fall, the university's enrollment exceeded 24,000. The primary priority for limited funds must go to instruction, undergraduate and graduate, and we urge you to continue the premise of the real resource allocation model, funding approved in 1999, which means state funds follow the students. Second, because access and excellence are at the core of PSU's mission statement, the Advocacy Committee urges you to support the governor's plans for increasing financial aid and allowing the universities to use tuition remission to attract highly talented students. Thirdly, while students are at the heart of the university, the faculty is the soul of the campus. An excellent faculty not only attracts excellent students, but it also draws additional resources to the state in the form of research grants and brings national recognition to the state and the university. Thus, we support increasing faculty salaries as a priority for state funding. Finally, the governor has made investment in capital construction in higher and Oregon university system institutions a priority, focusing on deferred maintenance. As part of this package, PSU would receive funding to renovate and upgrade Shattuck Hall. This building is situated on the PSU campus is an old elementary school. It needs to be renovated in order to be accessible to all students and to be more efficient. Deferred maintenance is a challenge at all public universities, and is especially difficult to address because it simply doesn't appeal to donors that new construction has. It's hard to put a donor's name on a pipe or heating or ventilation system. Ignoring the problem doesn't mean it'll go away. It'll just make matters worse. Obviously, there are more of these four areas that need funding in order for higher education in the state to remain competitive. However, these are the priorities of PSU and the PSU advocates, and they reflect the immediate needs of Oregon's largest university.
Thank you very much.
My name is Anita Olson. I'm the treasurer for Oregon PTA, and I sit here before you representing 23,000 PTA members. This year, Oregon PTA will celebrate 100 years of advocating for children in this state. My oldest son graduated from Cleveland High School last June. Not one of his 13 school years was untouched by one cut or another. In fact, to make sure his senior year was a full school year, Multnomah County voters passed the ITAX. My younger son is a sophomore at Benson High School here in Portland and is scheduled to graduate in 2007. 1 year after the iTax sunsets. He, too, has experienced nothing but cuts during his school career. In fact, it looks right now like his senior year may very likely be cut very short because of lack of school funding. It's been 15 years since Measure 5 was enacted and the school funding crisis began. For 15 years, the legislature has chosen to do nothing to resolve the crisis. The excuse of rough economic times doesn't hold water when you consider that the first 8 years was an economic boom in this state. And yet for 15 years, the legislature has chosen to do nothing to resolve the crisis. When will you and your colleagues choose to do the right thing for Oregon school children? Next. My mother taught me that you don't go to a group of people and voice complaints if you're not willing to stand up and offer some solutions or at least help. It is a revenue stream that needs to be brought to this state. My very favorite revenue that you could increase would be the corporate minimum tax. That tax of $10 is over 70 years old. My father was a school student in Portland Public Schools when that tax was enacted. Nothing in 70 years has not increased at all. For you not to consider that is irresponsible. Oregon PTA would be more than happy to meet with any and all of you to give you more information and more ideas on where we think you can come up with the revenue. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, we've got Chase, Mary Kay DiLoretto, Cassandra Villanueva. Some of my colleagues may have to be heading out, so please don't take it amiss. They do come from different parts of the state, so they have to head out. I hope that's okay with you. And we will probably have to be terminating things in the not-too-distant future. Please go right ahead.
Thank you. Good evening, co-chairs, vice-chairs, members of the committee. My name is Cassandra Villanueva. I live here in Portland. I need to slow down, so much energy. I'm a community college student. I'm not an expert. I don't have statistics, charts, and graphs. What I do know is that I'm a concerned constituent, I'm a registered voter, and I'm a taxpayer. And I'm a believer in the democratic process. And I'm concerned about the future of our state. And I wouldn't be a true Oregonian if I didn't come here tonight to express my concerns with the future direction of where we're going. And as Al Roker said, Oregon is in the worst situation when it comes to school funding. And I'm most alarmed by that statement. I'm even more alarmed that as a state, we rank fifth in per capita spending on corrections. And this is at a time when Portland is facing the closure of schools, the cutting of teachers, the cutting of school days, and the quality of our education system is drastically downsizing, and we should be number one in education spending. And I want you to know that public safety is one of my main concerns, as well as education. And because they are both my priorities, I have to say that we need to be smarter on our decisions, wiser in our investments, dollar per dollar. I'm concerned that the pathway from the schoolhouse to the jailhouse is more fully funded than the pathway from high school to college. Investing outrageous amounts of money on prison options instead of core education opportunities is not the way to go, and it's not where I want my tax dollars to go. And with that, I urge you to consider sensible options to public safety and prison overcrowding, and ultimately consider logical options, schools, not jails, education, not incarceration. And thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, can we get Terry Quinteros, Louise Curran, and Jonelle Bell? I'll have Alex Johnson, Tara Davison, and David Dixon, if they're still here, on deck. Go right ahead. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen of the committee, I want to thank you for staying late this evening to hear all of the public testimony. My name is Terry Quintos, and I am a constituent of Senator Carter's. I am a resident of Northeast Portland, and I am also the program director of Crime Survivors for Community Safety, which is a program of the Western Prison Project here in Portland. Crime Survivors for Community Safety is a group of survivors of crime, including myself as a survivor of a violent crime, who are asking the legislature, to take a serious look at the services that we provide for all survivors. We, as survivors, want to say that not only do we want people held accountable for the harm that they do, but we also want to get to the root of what made violence possible in the first place. That is very important to us, especially for myself, who knows, as a person who worked in domestic and sexual violence since 1989 in the state of Oregon, the amount of violence that happens within families, that for those families, incarceration or harsher punishments is not always the way that they want to go. They want to look at how they can make their families whole again and start a healing process for them and their communities. As crime survivors, that's incredibly important to us. And I've heard over and over again tonight the importance of education for all of the people living in my district as well. And we see that as crime prevention as well. Also, just on a more personal note of how I feel that the schools have failed our young people, as a longtime activist and a peace activist who has helped raise her nieces and nephews, I was devastated in this last year when one of my nephews decided to join the Army. And when I approached him and asked him what made him think that this was an okay decision to make, he said to me, "What other choice do I have?" And that as an 18-year-old, that I found that incredibly heartbreaking, and that I saw that not only as my own personal failure, as someone in his life who clearly did not give him clear enough messages about how to lead his life and how to help others, but as a failure of our public school system that did not give him enough opportunities to see another way out.
Thank you very much.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to speak with you all tonight. It's a sad truth. In the richest country in the world, we're here deciding what programs to cut and not add. For the record, my name is Johnny O'Bell, and I am the co-chair of the School Age Council. The School Age Council was started March of 2004 and is charged with bringing local governments, nonprofits, service agencies, students, teachers, and communities together in helping to solve issues affecting our students. This is a committee under the Commission on Children and Families of Multnomah County. I'm here today in support of the governor's budget and keeping CCF intact, as well as to urge you to support K-12 at an adequate level across the state. That does not further reduce resources going into our classrooms. Having had the pleasure of serving as a student representative 2 years ago on the Portland Public School Board of Education has given me an insight on what happens when we concentrate our efforts as a society on reactionary methodology. What happens is we continue to let students fail in the name of budget reductions, and we continue to let dollars determine the successes of our communities. The staggering truth is this is our norm, but the question becomes, what do we do about that? I believe the CCFs are answering that question. The CCF is changing the way we do business, one county, one commission at a time. It provides a model that is proactive in the forms of prevention and intervention, by becoming the catalyst for local community conversations to spur. The CCF of Multnomah County has proven to be an effective and needed body in our county. The changes we have made are there, and the solutions we hope to find are needed. On Monday, the governor kicked off the Hunger Awareness Week at Park Rose High School. At this event, we celebrated last year's immense success of the summer food program here in Multnomah County. This was a direct result of the CCF bringing cities, local school districts, agencies, students, and communities together. In doing this, we were able to create a plan that increased our summer meal serve to 254,000, a 56% increase over the previous year. 254,000 more mouths fed. Through volunteer time and citizen engagement, we have leveraged hundreds of thousands of dollars in this past year alone.
If you can move along.
I'm writing my conclusion right here. So as I leave here today, I challenge you, our elected officials, to do what we sent you to Salem to do. Find the very best of what is working, maintain that, and begin to realign and restructure what is not. I know that the task you have at hand is incredibly tough, and I commend you for your service on behalf of all Oregonians. But I urge you to not cut a program that is working on more levels than one. In closing, I leave you with this quote. It's a quote paraphrased by Einstein. You can't solve today's problems with the same mindset of creating them. Members of the committee, as a state, we have created problems. By not investing in our children, in our communities earlier, we have an epidemic that is hard to keep up with. I urge you to not continue to allow this epidemic to spread. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Okay, got some others coming up. Mr. Clements, Chuck Clements, if he's still here, Heidi Nichols, and Cole Sherborne after this group. Yes. Thank you, Chuck. Appreciate it. Please go right ahead. Ladies first.
That's kind of what we thought, too.
My name is Tara Davison. I live in Lake Oswego. I grew up in the small community of Colton. My graduating class had about 35 people in it. And it's very rare for students from the Colton School District to go straight to a four-year university. If they move on, it's more likely that they go to a community college. Very likely that they get into a vocational program, but some are university track. I was a student hoping to go to university. My senior year in high school, I had one class left to take, no electives to choose from. I was encouraged to go to Clackamas Community College. I went there full-time my senior year. By the end of my second year, I had been on the debate team for 2 years. Debate wasn't offered at my high school. And we went to a tournament at Linfield College where we competed against Willamette University, Linfield, PSU, several other big schools. And we defeated all of them. And as a result, the debate coach from Willamette University called myself and my coach and said, if we can't beat you, we want to join you. That was a four-year private university calling and offering me my ticket to a bachelor's degree. I went on a nearly full-ride scholarship. And it was a door that would not have been open to me otherwise if I hadn't gotten an excellent education at the community college. And I am here in support of funding for the community colleges because for people like myself who are university tracked and for people who are vocational, community colleges, we cannot afford for them to have to raise tuition to provide the same services. It's just not reasonable.
Thank you very much.
Vice Chair and Co-Chair and members of the committee, I'd like to thank you for being here today. I know some of you heard me yesterday, but you're going to hear a little of the same thing. My name is Alex Johnson. I'm a full-time student at Clackamas Community College, along with taking classes at the Adult High School Diploma Program at the college. I'm actually only 16 years old. About halfway through my freshman year, I got heavily involved with drugs until about November of my junior year. I was basically flunking out of high school, so I just dropped out. I went into rehab, and I started taking classes at Clackamas Community College. I've been sober since December. Because of my ability to leave my high school and be referred to Clackamas Community College, I have been sober, and I am going to get my high school diploma, whereas if I was staying in my high school, I would not be. I would be a bum, basically. And once I get my high school diploma, I'm also getting my AA at the same time. I'm joining the Marines, and I'm going to fight for our country and fight for people to have good lives here. There are plenty of kids in this adult high school diploma program who have the same story I do, or slightly different, who deserve the same opportunity to turn their lives around like I have. And Clackamas needs money to do this. And this is, you guys are the ones who have to give it to them.
Thank you.
I'm going to address you a little more informally as respected fellow Oregonians who care deeply about your community, and I mean that from my heart. My name is David Dixon. I'm executive director of the Clackamas Community College Foundation, and I, along with Senator Devlin, Senator Gordley, spent about 2 hours listening to story after story of lives that have been changed yesterday at the testimony for Education Ways and Means. And today I want to tell you some of the numbers behind the faces that you saw. First, about state funding. In 2001 to 2003, the legislature approved $462 million for community colleges. In 2003-2005, community colleges received $411 million, an 11% cut in real dollars, and considerably below what we were funded in 99-01. Community colleges responded with program cuts and tuition increases. We tried to minimize tuition increases at Clackamas. We cut 20% of our administrative staff in 2003. And now I'm going to look at the Portland metro area, Clackamas, Mount Hood, and Portland community colleges. At those colleges, tuition from 01-02 to 03-04 jumped from about $45 a credit hour to $61 a credit hour on the average, a 36% increase. At the same time, in the year 2003-2004, with these tuition increases, the number of students enrolled at the three metro area colleges took the largest drop in the history of community colleges. If you want to express it in terms of full-time equivalent students, we went from 43,000 to 39,000 full-time equivalent, 4,000 loss. That's about 9.2%. In terms of individuals, the loss was from 158 to 132,000, a loss of 26,000 people in our metro area, or 16%. And my point I'm making is the students we heard from yesterday were not unique. There's thousands of others for every one of them. And these stories are stories of people being funded by community colleges. I urge you to support community college funding at least the $440 million level. Thank you for listening.
Thank you. Let's get Frank Cobb, Lynn Shore, and David Wind on deck, please.
My name is Dale Sherborn. Thank you very much for coming here. I'm a member of Neighborhood School Alliance. Kids need both parents and dads against discrimination. I come here bearing money today. I think that the money is there to be found. The Homeland Insecurity Act has money to make sure that we have public schools open. We need to have each one of the public schools open in case of an emergency. We also need to have them fully funded with a nurse that's there every day of the week. We have a learning, we have a medical university in this state, and they should have a clinic in there and utilizing that as part of their curriculum program for public health, if you have to supply them with scholarships to do that. That way you identify the children earliest that have the most opportunity to be in danger, whether it be from abuse or for drug abuse. I advocate going back to the K-8 system, which will reduce costs, raise grades, and lower dropout rates, because you'll have community involvement. People won't move away as fast, and they want to stay there where their kids are, and they will become more involved with that. Bring us back local control. Get rid of Measure 5, 47, and 50 so that we can take control of our own needs in this area. That's what has ruined and why you have to deal with the education problem. Give it back to us. You won't have to deal with it, all right? Now, when it comes to cutting programs, I think that you wield a big stick.
you wield a really large stick and declare an emergency, put every state employee, every public employee on the Oregon health plan. Say the heck with all of these health insurance agencies. You want to fix the problem? We're going to fix the problem. And we're going to say, each one of you, go get the care you need. There's a schedule for minimum payments for health costs. Put that on your tax, take it off of there, whatever it is. We're not going to pay those high health insurance premiums anymore, and we're going to have our own pharmacy. We're going to sign up for a pharmacy and get all the drugs at wholesale. Now, when you go to cutting sports, I don't suggest that you cut tennis. I suggest that you do cut tennis, golf, baseball, football, all of the sports. At that moment when you do that, you'll see the manufacturers come out of the woodwork. They'll say, whoa, wait a minute. We got too much invested. If we don't have those kids doing that, they don't buy products in the future. And they'll come forward with the solution to fix that problem. So if you're thinking about cutting sports, cut them all, not just one, and they will come up with a solution. We can get our kids healthy by providing with a PE teacher in every school and make sure that they're healthy all the time and not just during the sports time. Thank you very much.
Good evening. My name is Lynn Shore, and I'm a member of the Neighborhood Schools Alliance. I'm a mother of two children in Portland, and I'm here in support of small neighborhood schools. I want to thank you for holding this forum tonight. For too long, legislators have been making budget policy decisions without considering their far-reaching impacts, so parents and children and educators really appreciate your being here tonight. I'm here to tell you about the impact Salem can have on Portland. Historic budgetary decisions made in Salem have resulted in the starving of public education in Portland. The state legislature is standing by while neighborhood schools are closed, neighborhoods are impoverished, low-income families are pushed out of Portland, poor people go without health and dental care, and good education is sacrificed. The Portland Public School Board is so beleaguered, it may not even realize the short-sightedness of school closure decisions. Ask yourself this. At what time in history has Portland ever stopped growing? The school board knows this city will grow. For a city and state that treasures open areas and green space, the fact that you will not provide neighborhoods with their neighborhood schools is appalling. Every market study of residential real estate provides indicators about the quality of neighborhood schools. A major intrinsic element of value in a neighborhood community is the school within that neighborhood. The neighborhood school is an indicator of the vitality of our community. When a neighborhood loses its school, it loses its identity, and it becomes impoverished compared to any other neighborhood with a school. These school closures will diminish property values in Portland neighborhoods and will make Portland less competitive. I believe the Portland Public School Board is paying lip service to the public policy process. At numerous public hearings, the board listened to over 250 citizen testimonies, not one in favor of the closure and reorganization proposals, but still they went ahead with the school closures. What is public process if you're not going to respond to the input that citizens work hard to provide? Everything seems predetermined, even the Jefferson cluster process and future configuration. I believe the board has abdicated responsibility for Portland Public Schools. The board was not duly diligent in not looking at the real costs to implement school closures. The board did not address the real costs of closing schools and busing more students. The school board ignored its own closure policy, which stated that any closure process should start in the fall. Their process started in the middle of February, and they voted to close schools in March. This flies in the face of common sense. What can Salem do? We request that you introduce a bill to prohibit any closure of Portland public schools or sale of school property or land without a quasi-judicial process. Schools and school land should never be sold for silver or gold. The land ordinances of 1785 and 1787 were passed by Congress to allow township squares of 6 miles by 6 miles. 1/16 of each township was to be set aside for public education, from the Mississippi to the Pacific Ocean. The land ordinances of 1785 and 87 separate us from every other nation and make us a model. They are a distinguishing characteristic of the United States. Our forebears knew you had to have an educated public to maintain a free society. Thomas Jefferson stated, if a nation expects to be ignorant and free in a state of civilization, it expects what never was and never will be. Please get us the $5.4 billion we need to barely survive. Please help us save and promote neighborhood schools. Help us fund public education in Portland. Help us to be free. Thank you.
Thank you for allowing me to come and speak with you, the senators and representatives. I sit here before you today as a single black parent. I have three beautiful daughters, two of which go to Jefferson High School. I have a son who is ADA, attention deficit. He is being inspired by myself to go to Portland Community College. I am a member of the Portland Community College. I've been a member for the past year, and I've sat in and listened on all the testimony here today. I sit here today and tell you, please don't cut the funding. We need the funding. Without the funding, it is my lifeline. I will be on the streets or a member of that jail that is being built that has no one in it. I don't want to be the first statistic to be in the jail. Please don't cut the funding. That's all I ask.
What was your name, sir? Name?
My name is Frank Cobb, Sr.
Thank you, sir. Okay, if we get Bobby Reagan, David Wynn, Doris Cameron Menard, any more Jefferson High School students here? Go right ahead.
Hi, I'm Heidi Nichols. I live in Southeast Portland. Thank you for the opportunity to speak about the importance of restoring full funding to the OSU Extension Service. I've been an OSU Master Gardener since 2000, and in that time period, I have seen the great value the Master Gardener Program and the Extension Service as a whole provide to this community. OSU Master Gardeners who volunteer their time are trained to provide research-based answers to questions confronting home gardeners throughout the state, not just in rural areas. In both urban and rural areas, these answers help citizens utilize the ever-shrinking supply of open space in an environmentally sound and sustainable manner. In 2004, Master Gardeners statewide volunteered more than 147,000 hours of time. This is the equivalent of 71 full-time employees and a value to the state of over $2,375,000 that they did not have to spend. In addition to the actual cash value of their services, Master Gardeners and other Extension volunteers may save state funds spent in other areas. By discouraging unnecessary or incorrect pesticide use, the state has saved the cost of cleanups. Providing information regarding sustainable gardening practices enables individuals who might otherwise go hungry or depend on public assistance to grow their own food. In addition, citizens who eat healthy homegrown produce may make fewer demands on the already stretched health care system. Volunteers who teach in programs that educate at-risk youth help these youths see alternatives to entering the criminal population. As the editorial in Sunday's Oregonian so eloquently stated, a fairly small investment in the OSU programs would result in valuable benefits to the entire state. I strongly encourage you to find a way to increase state revenues and thereby to restore the OSU Extension Service, its Master Gardener Program, and the OSU Agricultural and Forest Research Programs to their pre-2001 funding levels so that they can continue to provide essential services to the citizens of this entire state. This is an expenditure which will benefit all. Thank you for your time and for your concern for our state.
Thank you.
Good evening, Co-Chair Schrader, Scott, members of the committee. My name is David Wind. I'm proud to be the co-chair of the Portland School Board. Thank you for coming to Portland and for holding this public hearing. Somebody needed to watch cable television. When we have public hearings in Portland, a lot of people show up, and we needed a bigger room than this to fit everybody in. The school board in Portland is focused on an agenda of improving student achievement for all kids and eliminating the achievement gap that plagues poor minority children. We're focused on ensuring a quality education for every student in every school in every part of the city. We're doing this against the backdrop of two long-term trends. One is declining enrollment caused by a falling birth rate and the lack of affordable housing in the city that's forcing families outside the Portland Public School District. And the second one is continued fiscal challenges caused by the erosion in the real level of funding for public education in this state. However, as a board, we're facing reality and we're making difficult choices. I've been on the board for just less than 2 years. In that time, we've hired an outstanding new superintendent. We've voted to close 5 schools, 4 elementary schools, and 1 middle school. We're changing the culture of the central office. We've made some people changes. We've passed a policy on contracts to ensure that there are no special perks for administrators in Portland Public Schools anymore. And now we're in the middle of a budget process. I'm usually on the other side of the microphone. We're facing a budget with no local option because the double majority requirement means that there is no point in us going to the ballot in May of this year. We're reducing central spending by $9 million. We're eliminating 261 teaching positions. These are family wage jobs. If any other employer in the Portland metropolitan area was eliminating 261 jobs like that, there'd be a lot more fuss than there appears to be when the public school district does that. There's something wrong with that. I know you've got tough choices to make, just like we do on the school board. I urge you to do whatever it takes to find the revenue to fund K-12 education in this state at no less than $5.4 billion. That's not a hold harmless budget for the school districts in Multnomah County. The voters in this county are funding the schools at the level of about $6 billion a year through the end of next year. And after that, when the local income tax goes away, we're going to be cutting again. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your attention. Good.
Everyone, thank you all so much for being here. I really appreciate it. My name is Bobby Regan, and I am the co-chair also of the Portland School Board. I'm also the parent of 2 students in Portland Public Schools, and it's especially nice to be on this side of the table tonight. I want to take us back to January 2003. That's when Gary Trudeau of Doonesbury fame was lampooning Oregon nationally for our lack of investment in public education. His famous line was, "No child left behind except in Portland." In January 2003, Portland Public Schools was facing a 25-day cut in the school year. The following year looked even more bleak. At that time, a group of parents formed a grassroots organization called HOPE, Help Out Public Education. I was the founder of that effort. Our goals were simple: a full school year, reasonable class sizes, and a deadline to get a local funding measure on the May 2003 ballot to give parents the hope they needed to keep their kids in public schools. We fought for a 3-year temporary local funding measure to help all school districts in Multnomah County. 3 years was a critical timeline. We were confident that we needed funding in place locally to allow the next legislature, that's you all, to have the time this session to fix the underlying funding problem in this state. We need tax reform. But today, we face the same reality that we faced in 2003, only worse. The state continues to disinvest in schools, with our governor and the Joint Ways and Means Committee not even proposing a current service level budget. We can't go out for a local option or a local capital bond because the double majority requirement is an insurmountable hurdle at this time. The double majority is bad public policy. It allows voters who sit out in election more powers than those who care enough to vote. And due to the continued lack of adequate state funding, we are still completely dependent on our local income tax, which is set to expire next year. This, despite a 60% cut to our central office over the past 10 years, despite extensive school closures, contracting out our custodians, moving to propane school buses, and taking other drastic steps to cut costs so that we can keep our money in the classroom. With the cuts expected from the state and the expiration of our local funding measures, we expect our budget at the start of 2006 to be $100 million less than it is today. It's a 25% cut from today's funding levels. For perspective, if we eliminated our entire central office, that would save $18 million. We need a state funding floor of $5.4 billion, please. We need an adequate funding level closer to $6 billion to keep Multnomah County schools and schools across Oregon whole. And we need to begin once and for all, and I mean for all, the hard work of reforming Oregon's tax structure so we can stand proud in supporting our schools, our seniors, and our most vulnerable. And finally, please loosen the double majority requirement so those who vote know that their vote will count. Thank you again.
Co-chairs Schrader and Scott, Senator Carter. My name is Doris Menard, and I'm a member of the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill. You've heard many voices this evening, voices wanting dollars, wanting your attention, making very persuasive arguments. But there are others not here this evening whose voices are a lot weaker, but their needs are just as great. And they are the ones I want you to think about tonight. As a former educator of more than 30 years, I certainly support adequate funding for schools. But there is more than one priority for this state. Mental health funding cannot continue to absorb cut after cut to an already lean budget. The mental health piece of the funding pie cannot be sliced thinner and thinner year after year while the population grows and the need for mental health services escalate. The reality is the needs of individuals with mental illness impact all areas of our society, including schools. I urge you to make a commitment to those who are and who remain the most vulnerable and the least heard, the most in need and the least supported, the most neglected and the least understood. And a look at the Oregon State Hospital is certainly adequate evidence of that neglect. Year after year after year, legislature after legislature after legislature. Have you been there? Which is the greater priority, tennis for some children or treatment for sick children? I urge you to balance the budget by listening to all of Oregon's voices and be fair to all of Oregon's citizens. And if we cannot adequately fund the needs of all of our citizens, then I urge you, as legislative leaders, to fulfill your responsibility and the commitment you made when you took office, to find a solution for this lack of funding. I thank you for your efforts and your hard work tonight especially, and thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you. We're going to be not able to get to everyone here tonight. That's unfortunate, but we do ask you to send your comments in. I'm going to call Mary Scherzinger up. I'd like to get the med students and dental students up. We'll take about four or five others, and then we're going to have to call the union folks. I'm sorry about that. I really appreciate everyone's interest and attendance. It's been very impressive to all of us, I know. Thank you.
Okay.
Sean. Close the door.
The other people we'll get to will be Kathleen Pequeno, Rick Bennett, Norm Burney, Nigel Wrangham, and Devin Bryce.
You know, we spend 2.5 to 3 hours sitting here after our day job. I think all of us should have an opportunity to speak as well. We have been wringing our, all of the people who are sitting here have been wringing our hands over various issues all day. And I think that you guys owe it to us to wait until we've all had our voice as well. Yes.
I'll hold you to less than that then if I have to. All right. Please, go ahead, Mary.
Hello, my name is Mary Scherzinger. I'm a freshman at Wilson High School, and I've come to talk to you about the public school budget and its looming cuts. Some of my concerns are, will I learn everything that I need to learn in order to go to college? Will I even have a full school year next year? How many other kids will there be in my classes? And will my favorite teacher still be there next year? I love Oregon schools, but we are suffering from the budget cuts. It's like you're saying that you don't even care. I know you care that we're students, but you should think about our future as American citizens. I've interviewed some of my friends, and their main concern is electives. Most of my friends love to act, love to sing, love to speak different languages. And most of these programs will be cut not only in my school, but in schools all over Oregon. I'm not asking anything more than what we deserve, and so I hope I've given you a glimpse into the world, into my world of a public school student.
Very much.
Hi, my name is Adam Lindemann. I just want to speak quickly about the Food Innovation Center. I came from London to United States to pursue the American dream, and the Food Innovation Center has enabled me to do so. Basically, we're talking here about how to split up a pie, and I consider the entrepreneur's role as somebody who actually helps to make a new pie. But sometimes it requires a tiny little bit of help at the beginning, when an idea is so fledgling that nobody else, no venture capitalist, nobody would ever touch it. So that's the time when a public institution like the Food Innovation Center, which is a joint initiative with the ODA and OSU, can take an idea. In this case, it was fizzy fruit, which my business partner, Galen Kaufman, invented, which is a terrific idea, enables children to essentially eat more fruit by making it fizzy, a bit like sort of a mixture between the Pepsi there and the apple over there. An idea that makes a lot of sense, but, you know, it could have died 5 years ago. The FIC made sure that didn't die. I got involved in the project, came all the way from London, and it's definitely not going to die now. I don't need your help, but many, many more entrepreneurs probably will do, and it's the entrepreneurs that are going to make sure that the new companies are built that will ultimately ensure that more money is available so that in the future these kind of discussions are not being had. America, to me, is all about the future, so support innovation, and for all of these good people, support the education as well.
Thank you very much. Students, please come up.
Chair Schrader, Chair Scott, members of the committee, and Senator Morris, I graduated from West Albany High School. Go Dogs. Thank you for being here. This means a lot to the dental students. I'm the president of the dental student body, OHSU, and here tonight just to say thank you very much for what you've done for OHSU. We are watching. We see that you've put some of the money back.
into the budget, the House. I want to thank you very much for restoring the money to the dental school specifically. A lot of the students I represent very concerned that the budget decrease would go through, and that would amount to doubling our tuition. As it stands right now, we already start out about $500,000 in debt before we see our first patient. Once you get done with your undergrad, get done with your tuition costs at the graduate level, and then get by a practice. It's a huge burden. Most of us do it because we're intent on serving people. It's obvious that you understand the importance of supporting tomorrow's healthcare practitioners. And we want to thank you very much. We are essentially in class 8 to 5, Monday through Friday, and we can't get down to lobby days. And so for you to hold an event like this at night when we can get out, it means a great deal to us. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Tammy Scarborough, and I'm with the School of Nursing, and I'm representing many of the students there, and I'd like to thank you for giving us money back for the School of Nursing to keep our tuition from going up and to the means of almost costing us the amount that it would go to a private institution, which would drive a lot of the students out of state versus staying here and helping the economy. I hope to go on to be a geriatric nurse practitioner and work in the rural area and open a clinic there, and I'd like to thank you again for the funding, but it's also important to remember to fund all schools, and because education is our future. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
My name is Mizu Homimoto. Thank you for being here tonight. I am a student in the School of Medicine, and I'm speaking to you both as a student and as a future physician. And I'm very new to this, and it seems to me to be a lot about thinking about your values and using those to set priorities. And if the cuts that the governor has proposed do go through, that will mean cuts to the rural health program, cuts to children with disabilities, and cuts to people that are indigent, that rely on OHSU for their care. And these are vulnerable populations, and it seems really unfair to me when I hear that you're thinking about cutting basic health care for these people. And I understand that I hear about tax breaks for luxury items, for things like boats, for things like second homes, when some people don't even have a home. They can't pay for their health care. So I would ask you to really consider your priorities and consider your values in making these decisions. In addition, I'm able to work at the prison one day a week right now. And two things that I've taken away is that 9 out of 10 patients that I see there have mental health issues, and they also have multiple arrests. And the prison or the jail is really not the solution to these people's problems. What they need is better social networks, better family and better friends, and better health care. And so I would ask you also to consider that when you're making your decisions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Erin Schneider. I'm a graduate of Barlow High School and University of Oregon. Go Bruins. Go Ducks. And also a second-year medical student at Oregon Health and Sciences. As future physicians, nurses, and dentists, we are exceedingly concerned about the future of healthcare in Oregon. A lot of us came here and stayed here with the intention of practicing in Oregon and not contributing to the problem that Oregon is going to be facing of a provider shortage. We ask you to please, please restore the funding to all schools and also the CDRC. We can't afford to divert Oregon's future physicians to other states, and this is what we're afraid might happen if these cuts go through, because our tuition will go from $25,000 a year to $33,000 to $35,000 a year, and that extra $40,000 added on to undergraduate loans and the $200,000 that will be in debt will be too much for some of Oregon's best and brightest to want to stay here. On top of the rising malpractice rates for the professions, it's not a good situation for Oregon, and we would like to thank the House for reinstating some of the funding and just encourage you all to think about not putting another Band-Aid on Oregon's present, but thinking about our future in medicine, dentistry, and nursing.
Thank you very much. Just to follow, my name is Brad Dreyfus, and I'm a third-year medical student, probably one of the only third-year medical students able to be here because we are on the ward, so we're no longer in classes. I'm actually coming off of surgery on call night, so I've been awake for about 40 hours, so forgive me if I babble a little bit. I wanted to address a couple of things my cohort said, and I want to stress the fact that these cuts to OHSU and our education does not function in isolation to degrade Oregon's health crisis, even to a lower point. It's in conjunction with the problems with OHP and the reductions and the cuts there. These are going to serve to make what we call the Swiss cheese principle, where sometimes in medicine you end up getting a complication. It's not because of one problem. It's because of three or four that come together and actually put a hole. It's kind of the same concept. That aside, I wanted to speak about my own personal experience recently as a third-year medical student in Burns, Oregon. Exactly. Burns is a wonderful place to be, and I would not have been able to be on the rural health rotation if it weren't for help from AHEC, which is the Area Health Education Center, which supports almost all of the rural health care in Oregon. It's extremely important. Burns is a good example because it's in a county that has 7,000 people and over 10,000 square miles and only four physicians in all of that space. People travel 2.5 hours with chest pain to get to the hospital. Without the funding to keep the programs going, to train physicians, to train students to become physicians from Oregon, we're going to lose those valuable resources. My preceptor was actually an OHSU medical student who rotated in Burns. None of the physicians in that area come from anywhere other than Oregon. To move to a place that isolated, you have to be used to and want to live in a rural area isolated from the metropolitan life and culture that you find in the cities. On to the next point. In looking at the budget cuts for OHSU, it comes to a total of a gap of $32.8 million, including the funding for the CDRC. That is pennies in comparison to the cost it's going to add up to in the future. Especially when you think about what happens to people when they come into the hospital needing acute care, needing major bypass surgeries, needing amputations for diabetic ulcers. People who end up in the ICU end up with hundreds of thousands of dollars in bills. It doesn't take more than a couple hundred of those types of patients coming from rural areas to end up making more of a cost than you have in front of you right now. So please support Oregon students, not only at the medical school level, but educating the students to get to the medical school level.
Very good.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you, guys. Can we get Ms. Paquino, Mr. Bennett, Mr. Burney, and Mr. Rangham, and Mr. Bryce?
This is my last one.
Go right ahead. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Co-Chair Schrader and Scott. And I want to thank all the committee members. I know that you started your day very early this morning in Salem, and I appreciate you sticking through this all the way to the bitter end. Thank you also for Senator Carter. You're my state senator. I'm here tonight to talk partially as a volunteer with Bradley Engelhaus, a domestic violence program based here in Portland, Oregon. It's a shelter and a crisis line and transitional services for women and children escaping domestic and sexual violence. I'm also a member of Crime Survivors for Community Safety. I have been doing work against domestic and sexual violence since 1988 when I was first trained as a volunteer with the crisis line. What got me really concerned and interested in doing anti-violence work
was, well, the murder of my brother in 1985. I know a number of people that have been impacted by severe violence and murder. I have worked with survivors for years. I have heard horrible stories about what people have experienced and endured. And what I can tell you is that there's a lot of people working hard to provide support that survivors need. And it's actually, when you describe the state budget, it's not necessarily coming in the form of what you would describe as public safety. You know, when you talk about $1.5 billion for public safety, the vast majority of that is going to corrections, which basically means prisons. And prisons are not actually the leading way to support survivors. I know from talking to a number of people that when you fund education, you are funding public safety. When you fund emergency services, medical services, health care, early child intervention, those are all things that are going to be affecting people who have experienced violence and crime. And those services then are what I want you to think of when you think of public safety, not the prisons. And again, these services are helping hundreds of thousands of Oregonians who otherwise would be very desperate in their situations. So I just want to say, and the folks I've heard talk tonight, I'm just so inspired to hear the work that people are willing to do to support survivors, because I think that is what's happening when you hear people working in reading programs, you know, providing, again, health care and services such as that. So I just want to, you know, remind you again that when we talk about public safety, we're actually talking about a lot of other things, not actually prisons. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm actually speaking for Mr. Wrangham. He's a professor here at PCC, and he left, but I was voted to speak on behalf of the class. Thank you for your patience and for being here so late with all of us. My name is Justin Nielsen. I'm a student at PCC here at Cascade Campus. I'm currently seeking to be certified in drug and alcohol counseling. Oregon is going up a ladder that we shouldn't be too proud of, and that is drug use within the state, particularly methamphetamine. Congressman Greg Walden of Oregon's 2nd District has called methamphetamine an epidemic within the state. There is certainly a need for certified drug and alcohol counselors, particularly level 1 and 2. And if you look in the Oregonian in the Help Wanted ads, you will highlight just about every other ad looking for a CDAT counselor. This is one program that cannot be affected by the budget cuts, especially with the problem already existing like it is. I want to switch gears real quick and talk about the casino that the governor just proposed for Cascade Locks. Obviously, it would create extra revenue for the state, or the government would have its hand in it. Putting all differences aside, whether or not you want the casino, I think it's inevitable that it's going to be in. Things associated with the casino are highly addictive behavior, gambling being one. My question to you is, has the committee assessed the possible addictions, and how is the state going to pay for prevention, education, and counseling? Also, have you considered the secondary effects of the casino within the state? Secondary effects include crime, prostitution, alcoholism, and drug use. So it seems to me, by creating one single entity, so theoretically you produce an immaculate number of revenue, an incredible number of revenue, but you create all these other effects that go along with it that end up being more expensive.
Well, we're past our original scheduled line. I'm actually going to dismiss my colleagues and my staff because they got to get up tomorrow. I'll be glad to stick around and listen to some of you that have not had a chance to speak. I really do appreciate your efforts, and I'm sorry we've run out of time. We certainly didn't expect this overwhelming response. We'll be hopefully better prepared than some of our other locales. I, again, apologize and really commend this community for showing up. It speaks well for Oregon. Thank you very much.
Jobs. I was trying to think of the name of that fish down in Coos Bay, the flubber fish, or what was it? We shut down all the farmers, all the water, to save the little. That That's why they left. They didn't have a job. Okay, Senate Bill 801. Portland has bad breath. And unfortunately, bad breath, you don't know you have it. And people won't tell you. I'm telling you, Portland has bad breath. We have the worst economic climate for small employers in the United States. In the United States. It's the worst. And that is because they have a special tax. It's a special income tax that says if you're a small employer, we tax not only your net profit, but by the way, how much did you pay yourself in salary? Then we tax that. There's nowhere else in this country that does that. And that is why Portland has bad breath, and that is why that is bad business for Oregon. Because people come from out of state, they go to Portland, they get the bad breath, they leave. I hope that our very courageous, hardworking Senate president will ask Senator Deckert to hear 801. This is our third session to present it. Last session, it did pass the House, did not pass the Senate. This year, it did not get a hearing. 801, this bill costs us nothing. Nothing. And it will improve our economy statewide. If we improve our economy statewide, what happens to our funding for education without raising taxes? The next bill, this is second session, was...
If you can zip along just a little.
No, I'm done. This is the last bill. The last bill did get a hearing in Senator Deckert's office. It's interesting that it came Senate Bill 412. Senate Bill 412 has to do with urban renewal. And urban renewal, as you know, uses tax increment financing, tax increment financing to pay off debt instead of going to education. So you know what's happening to your education dollars. It's going to pay off debt instead. It's about a third of the tax dollar, property tax dollar. Okay, Portland's debt, urban renewal, the education portion, 2 years ago, $13 million. Isn't that a lot of money for education for Portland? $13 million is what that cost the state of Oregon. Last year, $20 million. Sorry for shouting. This year, $23 million. Next year, through the sky. Okay. Senate Bill 412 says, take all your police and fire and do anything you want local governments with your money. You do not touch K through 12. You can use anything else for urban renewal. Can't use K through 12. What's that cost the state of Oregon? Nothing. Nothing to implement. I've given you two solutions, 801 and 412. I hope, sir, that you will consider a special consideration for Senate Bill 801 and either talk to me or in some way use your influence such that Senator Deckert will give it a hearing.
Thank you very much. Who wants to go next?
Hi, I'm Helen with Stevens, and when I need to say something important to strangers, weird sounds can come out of my mouth, so I have to read. I know you asked us not to, but in these greedy days, with pressures down from the federal government and pressures up from taxpayers, state budget making is an impossible task. The federal government's fantasy is that slashed funds are reforms of corrupt programs, and the taxpayer's fantasy is that state government can do as well with less. That kind of means that the state government is where the fantasies stop and the realities must be faced. The core reality is a moral one. When our economic ship flounders, is it okay to start tossing bodies overboard? The answer isn't complicated. It's no. Oregon Project Independence is a vital last stand between the poorest of our poor and death. The governor's budget tosses 1,000 bodies overboard. Our elder citizens are best and most economically served by in-home care. And someone had just talked about that. The alternatives are more expensive nursing homes or death, fatal neglect. The government's budget caps in-home recipient care at 21,000. Bodies 21,001 up are tossed overboard. Our frail citizens may be best and most economically served by relative foster care. Again, the alternatives are expensive nursing care or neglect. The governor's budget throws 2,200 bodies overboard. This one's my pet one because the federal government makes Social Security disability applicants jump through an average of about 4 months of red tape before awarding disabled citizens with their SSD insurance. I've been there. My friends and I had no resources to survive without Oregon's Blessed General Assistance grants and health coverage. God bless Oregon's General Health Assistance for saving my life. The government's budget throws every single one of those bodies overboard. Both federal government and taxpayers pretend there are no endangered bodies, and it's left to state government to acknowledge them and to assure that no one gets tossed overboard in the name of economics or reform. Tossing bodies overboard is unacceptable. Just say no. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Finally, thank you very much for staying around here. Greetings, Co-Chair Schrader and Scott, Vice Chair Carter, and all the many members of the committee. Thank you so much for your commitment to the state. I really appreciate you staying this late to listen to all of us. And I need to tell you that as surprised as you were at the turnout here, I was awfully surprised at the number of turnout we have in front of us. So I only made 10 copies of my written testimony. I already gave one to Schrader and Senator Schrader, Representative Richardson, 7 to the staff, and I need one for my own notes really quickly. So. Yes, sorry. My name is Michael Van Cleek, and I am the owner and CEO of a small business in Raleigh Hills, and I'm also a member of the Washington County Commission on Children and Families. First of all, quick note on taxes, just so you guys know what the problem's like. This week, I paid my taxes for my company. I paid $5,600 to the federal government, and the state of Oregon has given me a $1,300 refund. I think there's a problem there, and I would have much rather written that check to the state and gotten that refund from the feds. But that's not why I'm here to talk. I'm here to talk about the Commission on Children and Families. The governor's budget and the House budget both recognize the significance of the Oregon Commission on Children and Families, what we've done in these communities, and they both recommend retaining us at our current level of funding. However, the Senate budget recommends cutting the Commission on Children and Families and moving our services to a combination of DHS and to the counties. And co-sponsor Schrader, speaking to the Salem Statesman Journal, justified eliminating the commission in an article on the front page of the local section today by saying the idea, quote, the idea is less regulation, more flexibility. Yet at the same time, this proposal proposes moving commission-based services to the DHS and to county governments, agencies who both incur far greater levels of regulation and inflexibility than the community-based, volunteer-driven Commission on Children and Families. I'm just going to highlight 7 quick points here and ask you guys a question. First of all, the commission coordinates and streamlines efforts of more traditional bureaucratic government agencies. In Washington County, we have the school boards, we have the Justice Department, we have DHS, we have businesses at our table identifying redundancies among their services and coming up with new strategies for our committees. No other agency in this state can bring those types of agencies to the same table. The commission is bringing additional outside funds to Oregon and is creating stability among our service providers by identifying grant streams outside of the state. For every dollar we get from the state, we're going out and trying to find a dollar outside of the state that goes to help our local programs. The commission identifies areas of local concern and gaps in local services through a citizen-driven strategic planning process. 200 citizens in Washington County wrote the commission's strategic plan. That wasn't bureaucrats writing it. That was citizens. The commission is a pioneer in developing accountability for public organizations. You talk about how important it is to know where your dollars are going. We've been proactive on that. We've been talking about what evidence-based practice means in our communities. While you guys are working to define it at the legislative level, we're working to define it at the local level, and we continue to do that without additional aid from the state. The commission is the only government agency whose primary mission is prevention. I can't tell you how many people here tonight have been talking about the problems we have with the rise in the corrections budget, how many problems we have with the fact that schools are getting students who aren't fully prepared for school. The commission is the only agency in this state that is tasked with prevention, tasked with feeding those kids when they're are 0 to 5 years old, tasked with finding prenatal care, tasked with finding what in every county in this state, whether it's Multnomah County, Washington County, Gillum County, which is a place where I used to live, so I need to preach that, Representative Smith. We are finding out what the gaps are in our communities and serving those needs in our communities through a citizen-based organization, and that is what I want to underscore. The Commission is citizen-run government at its best. It is a volunteer-driven agency, and it is a model for government agencies around the state. And what I want to ask, this is what I want to leave with, is Senator Schrader and Senator Carter, I would like you to explain to the taxpayers of Oregon how you can affix your names to a budget that would eliminate this volunteer-driven, citizen-run organization and reallocate our prevention money to DHS and to county bureaucracies. Thank you.
Very good. Very good.
Well, you know, now I know that poor guy, how he felt who had to follow Elvis on the Ed Sullivan Show. That was great. My name is Lisa Morris, and I live here in Portland, and thank you so much for honoring us by sticking with us tonight. I'm just a typical working mother in Portland, and I woke up this morning ready to just talk about schools, but the funding crisis has touched every part of my life, and it just blows my mind. At work, I do financial counseling for people who need a kidney transplant. And in the month of March, 57% of the patients referred to us have financial problems that are so significant that we don't think we'll be able to get them to transplant. Many of those patients qualify for the Oregon Health Plan's standard option, but that program, due to lack of funding, has been closed to enrollment. We'll have to turn some of those patients away, and no one lasts indefinitely on dialysis, and they certainly have a hard time being a productive member of the community while they're on dialysis. Once a week, I volunteer for the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill and the Family to Family program. I'm an educator for them. I have a dozen students whose loved ones range in age from 13 to 80. These people are the sons and daughters, brothers and sisters, husbands and wives. Mothers and fathers, and their loved ones suffer from chronic mental illnesses like schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. Not one of these families has found sufficient treatment or rehabilitation opportunities for their loved ones. Treatment works, yet spots go empty at outpatient and residential programs because there are not enough funds to hire the staff who could help the ill person through recovery and rehabilitation back to a productive, meaningful life in their community. Finally, last week, the crisis hit close to home. My son came home with the news that his teacher is being laid off as part of a cut of three FTEs at his middle school at Mount Tabor. He, as an incoming sixth grader, he was recruited by the principal into a special program called Cedar Lodge, where, according to the public school's website, each homeroom becomes a distinct learning community, which creates a close bond between students, families, and teacher through the 3 years they spend together. Being unable to count on adequate, stable funding is the death knell for a very successful, long-standing program when planning is no longer a possibility. Healthcare, social services, education, these are our fundamentals, and we know you're under intense pressure from what I think is a vocal minority of powerful people to continue to cut taxes that fund these essential programs. I'm asking you to remind them, the people that want more tax cuts or who object to a small increase in the corporate minimum tax, many hands make light work, and we need all hands on deck right now, especially yours, and we really appreciate them. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you all for taking the time, waiting all this time. For
thank you. I'm Dr. Fryer. I'm a family practice doctor here and provide service to a mostly Medicaid and Oregon Health Plan population down in Milwaukee. But I'm also a consumer of the CRDC, and I'm a genetic carrier of a disease called PKU, and I never knew that until my son was born with it. And my props are not for throwing, I promise. This egg represents 3 days worth of protein for my son. So if he eats the egg white, he can't have anything else with protein in it for 3 days. without getting poisoned. Okay. The potato, this potato is a one full day supply of his protein. When you cut the CRDC to the point that the metabolic clinic goes away, I can't walk down to the grocery store and buy him food. I can't do it. There are only about 140 of them in the whole state. Where am I going to get food for my kid? Yes, he eats potatoes, but he eats 100 grams of potatoes a day, and it is carefully measured. My family has 2,000 pages of diet records, and my son is 5 years old. Okay? It's just a last point. Working in California, I finally admitted to a colleague that my son had PKU. He said, oh, I have a woman with PKU in my practice. She's pregnant. I looked at him and I said, she's on diet, right? These kids, they're born normal. My colleague's child will not be born normal. She was not on diet. They're born normal. And by 6 months, you know something's wrong. And you know you're not Oregon. My brother's about to go into retirement. He's cooked for PKU kids down at Agnew State Hospital for 20 years. California's going to pay his retirement for a long time. My Uncle Bill's retirement is going to be paid for. He was a PhD taking care of PKU kids that filled a quarter of the mental hospital in Abilene, Texas. Pay me now or pay me later. We do the work. We do the 2,000 pages in 5 years. By the way, James is doing great. He's reading. He can add five column numbers, none of which he would be able to do without the support that we've already gotten.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Hello, my name is Vernon Baker. I'm here representing NERPAC, which is Northeast Rescue Plan Action Committee, which is a collaboration of network providers in Northeast North Portland who've come together to formulate a collaboration to work with services for educational services for youth and families in North Northeast Portland. One of the things that I wanted to speak about today was the budget cut, the state budget cut in the gang dollars, which will take place, which is taking place in this biennium to the tune of $560,000, which is greatly impacting the service-based services, or community-based services that we have providing at this time, which we all know that even though the dollars are disappearing, the needs for the services are still there. And because of the fact that the dollars are disappearing does not mean that the commitment of us who are on the front line providing the day-to-day services are going to diminish at all, but yet and still, those dollars are greatly needed to provide the well-needed services for those youth that we're providing services to. Along with the school, the dollars that are projected to be cut from the budget, the $12 million that are projected to be cut from the budget. Now, we've heard several testimonies about how bad that will be. And when I think about inner North Northeast Portland, especially the Jefferson Cluster, and how so many of our schools are tremendously behind and failing already, any additional dollars would just make that even more devastating. We talk about not leaving any children behind or closing the achievement gap. How can we do that if we continue to decrease our dollars? One of the most renowned community leaders here in Portland, Ronnie Herndon, he just has a saying that says it's like going out fighting a big battle with almost no stick at all. And sometimes by looking at the services that we have that we're losing, that's the kind of commentary that it looks like. And then just two more things. One, next, when we look at Measure 11, and the impact that it's had over the last several years that it's been incorporated. And when you look at all the analysis that have been done, it goes against all the best practices of center-based practices for community rehabilitative services or philosophy that's there. And we're trying to come together to talk about how we can get that measure recalled, because it's not doing any of our youth any really good. Because once they come in, they go to jail and they spend those years incarcerated, they're coming out. When they're coming out the same way that they went in. It's almost like their lives are put on hold. I volunteer with the organization that provides services to young men coming out to penal institutions on a regular basis. And some of the challenges and struggles that they've had on first-time offenses and situations is just devastating. And then finally, I'll just say this, that being a minister, associate minister in Portland in the community, and seeing the devastation that our community is facing with the lack of services and the resources, it's just getting immensely worse and worse to look at. Over the last year, I've officiated or participated or eulogized 10 funeral situations, and out of those 10 funeral situations, 7 of them were adolescents or young adults. And it's almost to the point now where the only time I would go to a funeral is when I'm called to participate, because it's just so overwhelming to the point that you just get tired of just seeing the same things happening over and over again. But we have to make a stand and take a stand and move forward, because our youth needs us. And we have a saying in one of our programs that we must not see through our youth, but we must see our youth through. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll try and be quick. Thank you for staying. My name is Ann Bedney, and I'm the parent to a beautiful, healthy 4-year-old boy, Evan, who happens to also have PKU, the phenylalanine. He cannot tolerate any protein, pretty much. Anyway, I was given the call when he was 6 days old from OHSU stating that I needed to come in right away, and from day one, they stood by my side from CDRC doing lab tests, nutritional follow-up, lab results, you name it. And I'm here to say please support CDRC. My son's life depends on it. I am grateful every day that he runs around, talks, you know, is learning his words, his alphabet, and without the people at CDRC, my son would have been terribly retarded. The metabolic staff help, and I have found no one, most physicians don't even know about this disease and are appalled that my son can't eat meat or have tofu or soy milk. And the people at CDRC and OHSU are godsends, and they are specialized. And so I'm asking you to preserve my son's life and to help make his life all it can be. So thank you very much.
Good evening. Again, appreciate along with everybody else that you have stayed. My name is Marilyn Hartzell. I live in unincorporated Washington County, Portland, Oregon. I am here as a concerned citizen of Oregon who lives here, who works here, who is raising my children here, and who seeks to obtain the best health care services available for my children, one of whom is a child with special health care needs, and who is gratefully a vital young man of 17. I could speak to you about many of the concerns I have, along with our other citizens here tonight, about Oregon, and they are deep and they are many. But I will focus my comments about the needs of children with special health care needs and their families. Children with special health care needs and their families need excellent coordinated care, such as those delivered at the Oregon Health and Sciences University and as through the Child Development and Rehabilitation Center. You have been thoughtful and generous with OHSU in previous times, and I am here to ask you to consider being so again. I would like for you to think about Oregon's children with special health needs and their families who rely on the expertise and coordinated care of excellent clinicians working together in an interdisciplinary clinical environment such as is delivered at the CDRC. In an interdisciplinary clinical environment, a child presenting with multiple and complex demanding health care needs can receive attention for all of their needs in an integrated and focused fashion. Without these services, Oregon's children with special health care needs, and they are all of our children and their families, are at risk of being shuttled from physician to physician who may not be familiar with their special needs from clinic to clinic in an effort to get all of their needs addressed. The impact of the lack of such services on families is increased time off from work, potential loss of pay, loss of school time for children, and an increased likelihood of unmet needs for that child that can have a negative impact on that child's overall development. When a child such as my son is seen for help, we need him to be examined and evaluated and cared for his lungs, his heart, his gastrointestinal system, his liver, his pancreas, his sinuses, and his overall well-being. Can you imagine life for my son, for myself, and for my family without an interdisciplinary clinic in which we can have all of that addressed at one time with physicians and clinicians speaking to one another? I cannot. Please think carefully and be mindful of the needs of our vulnerable children, our children with special health care needs throughout all of Oregon, and their families. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's a late evening. My name is Lynn Boos. I'm CEO for a nonprofit corporation called Community Services Incorporated. We exist for the sole purpose of caring for people who are mentally retarded and developmentally disabled. I'm an employer of 200 people, citizens in the state of Oregon. 85% of them earn $8 an hour. We have not had, as a result of public policy, an increase in the cost of living funds for this program, which is a $6 million a year program, in 4 years. People who earn $8 an hour cannot survive on that amount. That's aside from the fact that during this four-year period, we have had basic increases in our benefits that have exceeded 10% every year, to as high as 20%. We have had increases in our premiums for work comp insurance and other insurance that are in the magnitude of 15 to 20%. I am at a point where I can't lay off any more people in order to provide services that the state licenses us to provide at a specified service to ensure the quality and safety of these profoundly mentally retarded, developmentally disabled people. In the state of Oregon, there's about 1% of the population that qualifies medically for that condition. We serve the most profoundly affected of those, along with some other programs. And I can tell you that I'm not going to lay out numbers here for you, but I can tell you that programs such as ours, on which the state of Oregon depends and for which they receive 75% of federal dollars to support, are in jeopardy. We, at least at the quality of services that the state requires us to provide and with state-defined standards. So my encouraging words for you are that this program statewide needs a cost of living increase. The governor has proposed in the budget a 1.5% increase in January. To put that in perspective, I would require a 2.5% increase in cost of living in order to increase my wages by 25 cents an hour for people who can hardly live on what they get now and on whom the public interest depends for delivery of this service. So thank you for staying here. Thank you for bringing the democratic process to those of us who believe in it and have fought for it. And I encourage you and am willing to come to the Capitol and volunteer my time to work with any of you to help find solutions to a very difficult problem. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to thank everybody. It was very, very kind of you to stay this long time. Thank you.